Good morning. The Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. It's good to see you all here. Just a couple of reminders, since it's been a few months since we've all been together last, please turn off your cell phones, all the way off, not just to vibrate. I'm going to turn mine off. Because it interferes with the recordings. And now you all know with the new OLIS, people go back and use those recordings often. So we really want to be thoughtful about how things move. Representative Stark, do you want to join us up here?
I'll say a few minutes, but thank you for the
Okay, great. So because we're starting, I need to open up an organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules. Cheyenne, would you briefly tell us about our committee
rules? Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are no significant deviations. They've updated the rules as they do for the committees to reflect any changes between the long session and the regular session in the interim. If anybody had any questions, I could answer, but they are run-of-the-mill and identical in each committee based on the chamber rules.
Madam Chair, I move for the adoption of the rules as presented.
Senator Cruz moves for adoption of the rules. Is there any discussion? Did I need to open a work session, or did organizational meeting just work?
Organizational meeting.
Okay, great.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I was ahead of myself, so.
No, I opened the organizational meeting, but I don't have to say work session, right?
You're good.
Great.
We're
okay.
Good. Okay.
So he moved. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. All right. So I'm going to open up an informational meeting. We have a lot going on today. We're going to spend a lot of time looking at child welfare, foster care, and abuse issues a little later in the agenda, but we are going to start with an update on the proposed settlement in the Lane v. Brown case. That was the Lane v. Kitzhaber case, which had to do with supported employment and sheltered workshops. So I'm going to open up that informational hearing and invite Lilia Tennenty, Sarah Drinkwater first, and then we'll move on to Bob Leslie and Ruth after that. So we have room for everybody. And many thanks to the department. Somehow we ended up having both the Ways and Means Subcommittee and the Policy Committee scheduled at the same time. We have not yet figured out how to clone Lilia or Jerry, which is difficult because everybody wants to clone them.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennenty. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Drinkwater, and I am Assistant Superintendent with the Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you.
Thank you. This morning, we're here to talk just a little bit about a proposed settlement agreement that was recently agreed to between the parties in the Lane v. Brown case. Really, what this case is about giving people who currently are in sheltered workshop settings and those transitioning from school the opportunity to work in integrated settings in their communities. The agreement itself really embodies a number of efforts that the state has already undertaken to move in this direction, and it in fact acknowledges those improvements that the state has made over the past several years. We started many years ago, but ultimately initiated this significant effort with an executive order in 2013, and then we had that executive order reissued again earlier this year. And the settlement agreement itself basically notes that substantial progress and then solidifies the commitments we've made in the executive order as part of this proposed settlement agreement. It is really focused on making sure that people have access to competitive integrated employment in their communities. Historically, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in general have not had a full opportunity to access competitive integrated employment in their communities, and what we're doing with the settlement agreement is committing to continue to support those efforts and help individuals access those types of jobs throughout the state. We're looking at identifying and issuing guidance that speaks to the fact that we want people to work to the maximum number of hours possible or that they want to, with the goal of at least 20 hours a week. We are really looking at reducing the sheltered workshop population as part of this settlement agreement. And within the settlement agreement, the state ultimately, we feel, maintains the goals and the objectives and moves us in the direction we need to go, but also maintains some flexibility for the state to look at how we do this and how we go forward. As part of the settlement agreement, there'll be a court independent reviewer, and who will continue to work with us to make sure that we're meeting the benchmarks that we've established in the executive order ultimately and in the settlement agreement. We're looking forward to the next phase of this process, which ultimately is a hearing. I think the date has been set for December 7th, and that's when the sides, the plaintiffs and the defendants, will formally submit the proposal to the judge, and the judge will decide whether or not to approve the settlement agreement. So that's where we're at this point. We are doing our best to get information out about the settlement agreement because we know there's a number of questions that people and families and providers have. And so we're developing information that will go out and also talking about going out around the state and speaking to what's in the settlement agreement. Ultimately, I would say that we're also speaking to the broader move that's occurring across Oregon and nationally to transition people with intellectual and developmental disabilities into competitively integrated paid jobs in their communities.
Thank you. I'll speak a little to the specific items that have to do with students who are still enrolled in public schools, and specifically they're mentioned as the transition youth, and so it would be those students with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are in transition programs until they're of age 21 in the public schools. And related to the class action lawsuit that was filed in 2012, specifically there was concern about the risk of transition age youth who might move into sheltered workshops when they left public school services. And back in 2013, as part of the executive order that Lilia already mentioned, back in December of 2013, the State Board of Education revised OAR, specifically prohibiting placement of students for training or pre-vocational purposes or assessment at sheltered workshops. So that has not been allowable since 2013. Also, districts are not allowed to contract with sheltered workshops for assessments. So specifically related to the settlement proposal, there are a few things that the Department of Education will focus on along with our colleagues from DHS. And as Lilia mentioned, many of these items are contained in the Executive Order 1501 that was revised earlier this year. And we are looking at requiring the transition process for students in public schools to include the opportunity for community work and integrated work in their community while they're still in school. And there's also a provision to prevent mock sheltered workshop activities as part of a curriculum in schools. There is a definition in the proposal related to what is and is not a mock sheltered workshop activity. We're not wanting to sort of replicate for subminimum wage or just for the outcome or the purpose of a business work that is only done by students with disabilities. But a mock sheltered workshop would not be an instructional sequence that a student might be learning relative to generalization of some skills. We are also and had already planned and approved to change the post-outcome survey at the end when a student exits public school services. A post-secondary outcome survey is given to the student about 18 months after they have left, and that survey has been expanded to include a couple of more items related to the opportunities that the student had during school that were integrated, and then where they are at that point in time 18 months later. Are they working in a community job that's integrated? Are they in post-secondary education, and the kinds of things that transpired with them since they left school? Thank you.
Thank you. And sorry, excuse me. So one of the questions that I had was with the executive order that has been issued. We've had a lot of conversations about that within the legislature and the budget committee. If the settlement is approved, does that mean the legislature that's binding and the legislature can't make changes related to the state policy related to students going into sheltered workshops or placement in sheltered workshops in general?
The settlement agreement, if it is approved by the judge, would become legally binding, and there are provisions in there for modifying or if questions come up or there are concerns.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you for coming. This is an issue I've always been very interested in. I have a sheltered workshop just a couple of blocks from my place, East Co., and so I've visited it frequently. And I am most concerned about those that absolutely could not go into a community setting, into a business. And I assume that there are some. And I would hate to have services be deprived for those people who could not fit into a community setting. At East Co., I mean, it's like a family, and they actually go out and do social things also. So all of that would go away. I'd like to have that confirmed.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'll start by saying that ultimately, with an employment-first perspective or that goal, we want to start with the idea and the expectation ultimately that with the right support and the right job matching that everyone we support can work. We recognize, though, that there are going to be people who need additional activities to do during the day, and so there are a number of services that are available to people who may currently be in sheltered workshops that would still encourage social interaction and encourage social engagement. We have day service activities that people can participate in. We also have a lot of other types of employment-related activities that could be done in a group, or people can access the community through a number of services that we offer and provide. And ultimately, those are the kinds of questions that we're developing and talking to families and individuals in our case management service coordinator PAs about. Is yes, let's look at integrated employment, but we also recognize that people are going to need to have time to do other things during the day. So look at all of the other options that might help a person live a full life in the community, in addition to work or integrated work or things along those lines.
So you're saying that the shelter workshops would go away, but there are other services for those who could not be placed in a work setting. I mean, there are people that could not be put in a work setting.
We do support a wide number of people, some of them with very significant needs. And yes, what we're saying is that our goal would be that those providers work with us, access transformation or transition grants that are available, because they know the people they're supporting, the individuals and the families trust those providers that they're working with. As you said, they work closely together, and we're hopeful that most of our providers will stay engaged in that process with us and will ultimately provide other services that are available to the same people that they may be supporting, and ultimately more as we go forward. So yes, that there are other options available to people who may be today getting sheltered workshop services.
And Lily, there's a financial component to this as well, isn't there, with the change in the settings rule from CMS in terms of our ability to pay for these services moving forward?
Yes. When I said at the end of my presentation that we're going around the state talking about all the different impacts that are occurring or all the things that are occurring in regard to really supporting the idea of people working in integrated settings and accessing services in integrated settings. One of the biggest components is the home and community-based settings regulations that CMS issued in, I think it was about 2013 now. Basically, what CMS said is for states that receive home and community-based Medicaid matched funding, so any match that states receive from the federal government for HCBS services, they set out a list of requirements or criteria that the settings have to meet in order to continue to access those services. At this point, we're working very closely with OHA, with our APD, with the mental health system. We're all together putting together a global transition plan that talks about how we will make sure that all of the settings that we provide funding in meet these expectations. And right now, as we look at this, it's very clear in these regulations that sheltered workshops are not going to meet the criteria for being an integrated setting, which means that in the time frame that CMS provided, which is about March of 2019, we've got to work with providers, we've got to work with communities, we've got to figure out kind of what our transition plan and where we're going next for these particular settings is, because the federal funding for these programs after March of 2019 under these rules will be difficult for the state to access. So that's a big part of this. Definitely the settlement agreement is critical to this, but we also have coming behind it the HCBS settings regulations, and then also the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act that guides vocational rehab also is pointing in this direction. So you've got everything ultimately at the federal level moving states in the direction of serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in integrated settings in their communities, whether that be in employment or in day service settings or residentially.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just some real concerns. One thing I know about executive orders, they tend to be aspirational and not necessarily reality-based. And I can go to 40-40-20 as a prime example of something that's aspirational and makes no sense in the real world. Senator Mona Sanderson hit a point that I think is very important, and especially if you get into the rural parts of the state where we already have 25% unemployment. You know, I got a lot of people in my community that it's their community is set, and they're doing very good things, and they're operating it basically at the top of their abilities now. I would suggest that. And I know CMS is doing what CMS is doing, but I would also suggest that we take a hard look at how we define what we're doing, because you can redefine things and maybe meet the criteria without necessarily making the major changes that you think you have to make. Having said that, 2019 is still a long way off. And a whole lot could change between now and then, so I don't think we should look at what the federal time frame is as something that's cast in stone and won't be changed, because I think we'll see other states that are wanting to push back on this, because quite simply there are people that this is the best place for them. We know that, and I'm not arguing with mainstreaming people in as many ways as we can. I'm not arguing against that. What I'm arguing for is those that can't be. And I don't want them to be lost in the wash of this wonderful thing the feds have put down upon us. So I'm hoping, Madam Chair, that we look at maybe some definitional ways to kind of work around the system at the federal level.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. What I would say in response to that is definitely we're looking at all. Our biggest concern is that the people we support have access to the services they need, and we do want them to be integrated in the community. And not only because of CMS, but in the DD system in Oregon, this has been a big historical move. And I often talk about how many years ago, Oregon made the decision not to serve people residentially in congregate group settings in institutions. And this, it's difficult, and we know there's a lot of work that has to be done, but this is kind of the next phase of that. And so we are going to work very hard to make sure that we don't leave anybody behind. We're going to rely heavily on our partners, on our provider agencies, on our service coordinators and our PAs. They really are the ones that are going to have to help us move this forward, and we want to be good partners with them and help them do that, and really talk with individuals and families about what's possible. A lot of times we set low expectations because we just don't think something's possible, and I think I'd like our system ultimately to err on the side of setting high expectations and then supporting people to the extent possible to get there, and supporting them to getting them there as far as they can go. So that's, I think those are good points and definitely mm-hmm. things that we internally and with our partners talk and think a lot about.
Just to follow up, and I have no problem with setting high expectations for people. That's totally appropriate. But I'm hoping that as we transition all this stuff, that we're focused on the needs at the community level, not the requirements from the feds, because there is always a way to circle around something that the feds are doing. We do that sort of thing all the time.
Thank you.
So I would just add a slightly different perspective. It's been interesting to watch this unfold, both as a policymaker and as a parent. My son is actually a member of this class and is a person that would have been transitioned into a sheltered workshop, and we've watched his transition services both at school and through the DD system change. And one of those things is discovery. He's the first person in Benton County to go through a discovery process where you go and interview people. He had an informational interview this week, and I had very low expectations for it. I thought, how is this going to work? How is he going to come up with questions? What's he going to bring back from this? And I was feeling kind of guilty because in my mind I was questioning what we were doing. He went to this interview, asked phenomenal questions, came back. He himself said, we need to write a thank you note. He asked to access more speech therapy services because he was interviewing a voiceover artist and he wants to be a voice actor, and he understood how that was a barrier to him. His sister practices soccer to get better at soccer. He needs to practice speech so he can work in the community, and he could talk concretely about the things that he needed to do to get a job. I didn't expect that of him, and without the services that were described in the order, he never would have had that opportunity, and I wouldn't have known that about him. So I'm really grateful for it. I think that we will be surprised by the number of folks that find great opportunities as a result of this, and I look forward to continuing to be challenged. I know the fears out there are real because I have some of them too, but I think what Lilia said, these are some of the same fears we had around the closure of Fairview, and we don't have people asking to go back to the institution. It took some time and some bumps, but I think we'll get there. Anything further before we move on to the next
program? Yes, and I am excited about the program. I'm, you know, but there are high functioning, there's a spectrum, and there are high functioning individuals, and then there are those that are not high functioning. And I know when we deinstitutionalize some of these kids and adults have very supportive parents, and others do not. And I know when we deinstitutionalize, now this is just no scientific data, a lot of them had ended up on the streets. They didn't have. I don't want them to end up in the homeless, and because so many mentally ill, not necessarily disabled, I don't know, but mentally ill are homeless. And so the quality of life of these kids in transitioning is very important. But I am excited about the program. I just don't want anybody to fall through the cracks, which I felt happened with some when we deinstitutionalized.
And you're tracking some of that, aren't you, through the policy group, some of those metrics, how many people have been served, how many people were served, and where are they?
We have been tracking as part of the executive order where people are going and what's happening with them. We'll be doing that, though, now with more vigor, if you would say, because of the proposed settlement agreement and because those are the standards that we'll be held to. And that's ultimately, from our perspective, what you're speaking to is very important and critical. We have to make this work for every single person, regardless of high or low level of need. It has to be individualized, and that person has to be supported effectively throughout the process. So I think those are very good points.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Lilia, thank you very much for
thank you.
Coming. Next, we've got Ruth Morris, Leslie Sutton, and Bob Junda, please. Welcome.
Do you have a preference?
I leave it up to you.
I'll dive in.
All right. Thank you, Leslie.
Great. Good morning. I'm Leslie Sutton. I'm the policy director with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. We work to advance social and policy change to make sure that Oregonians with developmental disabilities, their families, and their communities can live, work, and learn together. Our members include Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities, their families, community partners, and also state agencies. We are federally mandated to assure that people with IDD and their families have access to services that promote self-determination, integration, independence in all areas of community life. This includes integrated employment, and this is something that we continue to hear that families and self-advocates are asking for, is to work as a member of their community. Time and again, we hear from self-advocates that they're just like everybody else. They just might have different support needs. We hear that they want to work in their communities alongside their community members. And we believe that Employment First and the Lane v. Brown proposed settlement really listen to this need and put Oregon on a path to make integrated employment a true reality for Oregonians with IDD. We really look forward to partnering with DHS, the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition, Disability Rights Oregon, and other members of our community to really implement this settlement and continue Oregon's Employment First services. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ruth. Yeah. I'm Ruth Morris from Springfield, Oregon.
And again, for the record, my name is Leslie Sutton, the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Ruth has asked me to support her in her testimony by asking a few questions today.
And hope everybody could hear me.
Yes.
I belong to an organization, well, I'm representing OSAC in this. And I belong...
And Ruth, will you tell us what OSAC is?
I'm getting
okay,
there.
Great.
OSAC is... Okay. I belong to an organization called Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition, and that's part of OSAC. And
what does OSAC do?
We have meetings, and we talk about jobs in the community.
Does OSAC have an employment policy statement?
Yes, and it's on the back of my testify papers.
If you could summarize it, what does that policy say?
It says people with disabilities can work in the community, and they are in favor of it.
And does OSAC support the Lane v. Brown proposed settlement?
Yes, they do.
Why?
So... And so people could work in the community and be like everybody else.
Did you used to live at Fairview?
Yes, I did. And I didn't like it because I couldn't go out and get a job.
Have you worked in a sheltered workshop?
Yes. I worked at Goodwill in Portland, and they had me doing steaming clothes. And I was afraid to get steamed because I was afraid to get burnt.
Did you only work with people with disabilities?
Yes, I did.
Have you worked at a community job?
Yes. I worked in Portland as a nurse's aide, and I was the only one with disabilities. The other ones was normal, and I felt good because they treated me just like them.
Did you like that job?
Yes, I did, because I got to do things.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Bob.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. Disability Rights Oregon is one of the law offices that represented the plaintiffs in Lane v. Brown. And the summary that was provided to you by Lilia Tentity and Sarah Drinkwater was totally accurate in terms of what the case is and what the posture is. I thought it might be useful just to talk about some background in terms of why this case came forward and what it's intending to achieve. Our organization, of course, is called Disability Rights Oregon, and the focus of the organization is to enforce those rights. And the rights that exist for folks with disabilities really came into being beginning in the 1960s as part of the civil rights movement. And the idea started to be developed that people with disabilities were a discrete group of individuals who have a common history, and that common history is really centered around exclusion from society, usually through institutionalization or a denial of access to the basic parts of life that we all experience, living in one's own home, having an income, having a relationship, being able to interact with businesses, with people in the community, friends, and so forth. The way that this manifested itself, say, going back to the 1950s, was that if a child was born into a family and they were diagnosed as having a disability, that it was recommended that they be taken out of the family and placed in an institution and cared for the rest of their lives. The And the family was usually told to forget about that child and move forward with their lives. There's a movie called Where's Molly? I think you've heard about that, which is a very powerful movie that talks about the experience of a family in Astoria that gave up their child. And I bring this to you because by today's standards, what we did and was considered to be the best practice at that time, by today's standards, is counterintuitive. And the way that I would put it is this. If you take a person who's born and we recognize has some limitations in their ability to learn and to succeed in life, our solution to that was to deny that person education, to deny that person training, to deny that person interaction with anyone other than those who were paid to care for them, and to essentially place them in large rooms to in a type of environment that we would, by today's standards, consider to be neglect. No parental contact, no language development, none of the things that people need in order to move forward in their lives. And so what we've learned over time is that to the extent that people can interact in society, that they can be engaged, that they can get a good education, that they can get vocational training, that they can have help with getting jobs, that they live better lives, their families have better lives because their children are more involved, more self-sufficient, that it's kind of a win-win. It's also a win-win in terms of public benefits because the less dependent a person is, the less that person becomes a burden upon society as well as their family. So Disability Rights Oregon came into being in the 70s in order to enforce those rights, and one of those rights has developed under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed in 1990. And part of that act was something called the Integration Mandate. And it essentially says, and says now, that if a person with disabilities is receiving public services, that person has a right to receive those services in the least segregated setting that is appropriate to their need. And so that standard was first applied to state institutions such as state mental hospitals, state developmental disabilities facilities, because there were some states in which if a person wanted a service, they had to go to the institution and there were no community services available for them. And what the ADA basically said and the Supreme Court affirmed in the case of Olmstead versus LC was that those individuals have a right, an individual right, to be served in the community with non-disabled individuals if that's what they would like and that is what is appropriate for them to succeed. And so what Lane v. Kitzhaber did, and I'm moving forward, is it applied those principles to the employment arena, employment services. We're very happy that we've been able to get to the point of having an agreement with the state where we are in agreement that that by continuing the work that the state's doing, that we'll be able to succeed in having a system that offers a variety of opportunities for people. And whereas before, we just didn't have that variety. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Great. Thank you all very much. All right. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the proposed settlement on Lane v. Brown. Briefly, the update on the statewide mental health tour. As you know, we are working with the Oregon Health Authority. There was a budget note at the end of the regular session that asked the Oregon Health Authority to conduct community forums in at least 5 communities around the state to focus specifically on speaking with consumers. We've scheduled 6 of those, and there will be a 7th that will be a virtual town hall so that people can call in from around the state. The cities we're visiting are Klamath Falls, LaGrande, Bend, Astoria, Albany, and Portland, and then the virtual town hall. We had the first forum last Wednesday night in Klamath Falls. Lynn Saxon and I were there. Both of the Witsits were able to join us. I was a little bit nervous and wondered, will people come? NAMI and the Oregon Family Support Network were incredible at helping to get the word out. We had over 100 consumers of addiction services and mental health services come. The way that it's set up, we've got facilitators, a chief facilitator from Portland State and some volunteer facilitators from NAMI and Oregon Family Support Network. We have round tables that are set up around topics such as older adults, youth in transition, adolescents, and the discussion is focused around three key questions. One, what's the best thing in your life right now? And what's the greatest barrier that you face? What has your experience been in accessing services? And then the last is, what would really work for you? What would be really great in a system of services? And the responses that we've gotten have been incredible. They'll all be compiled at the end by Portland State, ready for us for next session, and they will be in a visual format. We'll be in LeGrand on Friday. I really especially want to thank the Oregon Health Authority staff, who's done an incredible job setting this up. We run them from 5 to 8 so that people are able to come after work. We're providing a sack dinner so that if people are living in a residential facility, they're not missing their dinner. There were children. And Lynn Saxton is attending every single one of these, which I think is a tremendous commitment from the director to do that. And we invite you to join us at any or all of them as you see fit. And that's the update. Any questions about?
No, I was excited when I read the email that this was happening, and was so glad that you were going to be able to be a part of it. It's sort of like what we did with health transformation, going around all over the state and gathering information. And I hope we are going to have a product where we can really, I mean, we need to make so many more inroads regarding mental health. So let's, I wish you well.
Well, and I would just say quickly, what was really striking in Cave Falls was the really raving about the quality of addiction services in Klamath Falls. The biggest challenge seemed to be access to inpatient beds. There is no, in all of Klamath County, there is no hospital bed available when a person is having an acute crisis. So you've got people boarding in emergency rooms or having to go very far away from their families. And of course, housing, transportation, all of those issues really pop up.
Madam Chair, you'll find similar situations in a lot of rural Oregon.
Yeah. So. And that's one of the reasons why we're really focused on rather rural areas. I've learned a little bit about the politics of the state. So Medford was concerned that we weren't going to Southern Oregon. I had thought Klamath Falls was kind of southern, but it's south, but it's not that. So hopefully
on the other side of the mountain.
Right. So it's like south central. I'm learning. Anyway, thank you very much. So that is the update on the statewide mental health tour. So we're going to jump ahead for a minute because we have someone that may need to get back to Portland. So we're going to jump ahead to the last item on the agenda, which is the children's foster and residential group homes. So the goal for today, we're going to be talking a lot about all of the aspects of child welfare and abuse generally. So some of the topics we're going to cover today are abuse reporting and screening. How does information transfer between entities, law enforcement and DHS child welfare and DD or adults or TSPC as we have people moving through. We're going to have a review of the critical incidents response team reports for the last 5 years to look at some of the trends in there of things that the department has identified that they can do better. And we're going to look a little bit about at safety and circumstances within foster residential and group homes. As we were building this agenda, I think many of you heard about an issue that came up in the Portland area that raises some questions about what tools the state might have to monitor the conditions inside foster homes and group homes that might be overseen by a contractor. And part of the challenge of that oversight is that DHS is really and we are hemmed in by very, very restrictive records disclosure. So it's very hard to put some sunlight sometimes on what's happening in some of these places. But we do have an obligation to make sure that when we have kids or adults or anyone that's in state paid care, that we are providing the best possible resources from them. So we're wanting to take this experience that's kind of surfaced in Portland and see what we can learn from that. What can we learn about the barriers to making things better? How can the department kind of reach into that and find a way to better serve those kids? And we have an individual who's been willing to come and talk a little bit about her experience working in one of these facilities and her experience and the barriers that she had trying to alert people to what was happening to some of the kids that were there. So Rachel, do you want to come on up? So Rachel's going to share a little bit of information, and then we're just going to move into a broader discussion of foster residential and group homes in general. And again, the goal here isn't, as the legislature, we don't have the authority to police or monitor any particular organization, but we do have an oversight authority and responsibility in terms of the Department of Human Services and how we're meeting the needs of kids. And so Rachel and I had the opportunity to speak last week. She shared a lot of information that I think is important for us to recognize in a public kind of a way, and she is going to be following up afterwards with DHS now that we're able to connect her with folks that might be able to help with some of these things. And so I know you've not been to the legislature before, so you just start by stating your name and then just kind of retell your story. And again, remember that part of being careful not to share details about kids that might personally identify those kids.
Okay. My name is Rachel Rosas. I worked at...
And can you pull the microphone just a little closer? Thanks.
Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. Yeah. I worked at Give Us This Day April 2010. I was hired in 2011. I was hired when I was 20. And I worked there until July 2013, and I was brought on because I have experience with violent offenders and gang-affected youth, and the foster home. The program was supposed to be culturally appropriate, and they wanted my expertise. That was my understanding. So when I was hired, I was placed in an all-girls residential home, so there was, at the time, 15 children in placement. And my first, I hadn't worked any residential work before. My first red flag was our first paycheck. They weren't able to pay us. And I asked the director, how can that be if I know that there's state funding? I don't know how the money isn't available for us. Sorry. And then just other things started happening that I just felt like shouldn't happen in a residential home. There was no budget for groceries. We would have to go on our own to pick up food from food banks. There was no meal plan for the children. I know other residential homes and programs, they go to counseling. They have LifeWorks workers and things like that, and the children just wouldn't go. They just seemed locked in the houses. They were just there, and they said, they had told us that the homes were not locked down, but the children weren't allowed in or out. And the age range was 9 to 18. So, sorry. I don't.
You're doing great.
Okay. And then, so we were having a problem because most of the cases that come into the home are, well, they would tell us they're the kids that nobody wants. They're the difficult cases, and we just have to deal with it. So after the staff was kind of like, well, we don't have any training, most of the people were just friends of the director of the program who needed a job, so she would take in people from the community that needed jobs. When this kind of work is not to do favors for your friends and bring them in, they need to be trained, you need to have experience, and the kids just weren't getting what they needed, and it was frustrating for me. And whenever I would bring up issues, like one of the rules was not to let DHS workers upstairs, because they had redone the downstairs portion of the home, but the next two levels, one level was closed off because it had been destroyed in a fire, and then the other level was just, there was mold and there was flies, and it was just disgusting. And they would call us in on our days off, not paid, to clean the homes. And when I would mention, well, why don't you hire someone to clean the homes, or why don't we come together and see how we can make this better, they would tell me, well, if you don't like it, you can quit. We don't need to have you here. I wasn't going to quit, but it was overwhelming. So we got CPI trained, which is crisis prevention intervention training. we learned three holds that we were allowed to do when the children were a threat to themselves or harming themselves or harming someone else. And the way that the program took this was, now I have the authority to physically move the children around, push them around, hold them down on the ground, which wasn't one of the holds we were supposed to do, because these were little, I mean, some of them were 9 years old. And when I would take that to the case manager, so there was an internal case manager who would then pass the information on to a DHS worker, they would rewrite my statements. They would rewrite my incident reports. They would rewrite my BRS notes. And those would be then passed on to DHS workers without my signature. And when I found out that was happening, I also found out that the hours that we tracked, because it wasn't electronically tracked, we just wrote it down on a piece of paper, they were altering my hours. So some days I would work 15 hours, it would be stated that I worked 8. So it was just, I mean, is she, the director of the program hid under this blanket of, we can provide these children what's culturally acceptable when no one else can, and the majority of the cases, that wasn't true at all. We had cases of children that would come in the home that would be violent offenders or they would be gang members, and they made sure that if they couldn't make them a one-on-one, they would pass them on to a higher level of care facility, whether that be lockdown or, you know, juvenile detention, because they didn't want to deal with what they claimed to specialize in. They wanted to keep the children that were severely mentally ill, that had no other families, that nobody would come asking questions. And my biggest thing why I had to leave is because I couldn't take a part in that anymore. I had tried to talk. There were great workers, DHS workers, that came in and asked questions and would pull their clients out. And parents that would call asking questions, but it was difficult.
Can you talk a little bit, when we talked on the phone, you talked about some issues with medication and also some safety related to glass windows and...
Yeah, so the medication, none of us had any training on how to pass medication, so they briefly with the director taught us how to pass medication, but they didn't understand the severity of if a child misses his or her medication, that could affect their behavior for the rest of the day. So instead of writing an incident report or something like that regarding medication, they would just fill in the blank. They would just initial it for someone who was working that shift. So if it was myself, they would put an RR in the medication log when I either didn't pass the med or wasn't on shift doing meds at that time. When I asked them, well, you can't really sign my name because then that puts, I'm responsible for that med. And they're like, well, you know, we don't want to deal with DHS asking why the children are not receiving the medication. So, I mean, that's just kind of how we do things. And again, if you don't like it, we don't need you here. So it was always kind of... either you deal with it and you have a job, or you can move on because nobody's going to listen to you anyways. So, and then there was an incident with the glass windows. There were big glass windows in the dining area, and they were always getting broken. That finally, they got broken so many times that they just kept wooden boards on the windows, and they were there for months. Just closed out, dark room, wooden windows. And the incidents that caused the window to be broken was... the staff didn't really know how to deal with the children. They would kind of antagonize them and pick at them and cause them to explode, and then they would be a one-on-one, which is more funding, which is one-on-one services were almost completely non-existent. There was no, this is a one-on-one and this is what you do. It was just like, well, who's going to be one-on-one today? You look good. You're fine. You be her one-on-one. And that was it. There was no description of what a one-on-one was or what extra funding or what extra care the child needed. So this individual, this client, she was aging out of the program. She had been in numerous foster homes, residential homes, because of her case. And she just ran to the window and tried to jump out the window. And nobody used their CPI training. It was It was a pretty big deal. She picked up shards of glass and started cutting herself with them. And when I kind of broke down, because I didn't understand how nobody came around asking questions later, they told me the same thing. Well, we'll write the incident report, you know, and if you have a problem with it, you don't need to be here.
What was your training around your responsibility as a mandatory reporter to make a report of abuse or harm within the facility?
Well, at the time, I worked at different foster care agencies now, and I can kind of see where the disconnect was with that one specifically, but they told us if we had concerns with the children or abuse that was happening between the clients or between the staff and clients, to tell the case manager who worked with the company, and then she would pass it on to DHS, and that was our chain of command. That's how they explained it. The chain of commands are, you tell your house manager, who tells the case manager, who then passes the information on to DHS, and you don't worry about it, we'll take care of it. And it just seemed like if I had a concern I was 20 at the time, but I should be calling the DHS worker direct or faxing them the incident report. There's too many people involved on the way to get to the DHS worker, because like I said, some of them, when we would tell them, well, they said, you know, you can't come upstairs, they'd be like, well, I'm going upstairs and I'm going to check the home because this is my job and this is what I do. But sometimes they would just accept it, just drop the kid off, because they're the hard cases that nobody knows how to deal with. And the director, she understands that these are cases that people aren't going to ask many questions because it's the last stop before lockup or institutionalized care. So,
and then could you talk a little bit about the condition of the living quarters for the kids, kind of what was upstairs, the availability of toiletries, food, what the kids said about?
Yeah, so the beds that they slept on were just plastic mats, and they're supposed to be covered with a protective sheet and then another sheet and change them out when the kids come in, but they wouldn't sanitize, they wouldn't clean when one would leave and one would come in, so there would still be leftover, just filth. It was just filth, and there were always flies, and there were rats in the home. It was not a place that I would even want to spend time working in, let alone this is where these children live. So there was three meal times, but most of the time, since there were no meal plans or no budget for groceries, we had to just be creative with work with what we had. If we only had cheese and bread at the time, then they were going to have grilled cheese, one grilled cheese sandwich for breakfast and be off to school or to stay in their room all day. And if they said they were hungry, well, they would say, too bad, the kitchen's closed. There was no alternative, like you can have an apple or some graham crackers. There was no designated snacks or med snacks, nothing like that. So they would just kind of tell them, if you refuse your meal, then that's too bad. You're not going to eat then, just go to bed. And you can't. I couldn't just refuse them food, so I would go open up the kitchen and get them an apple or something like that, and I would be reprimanded for that.
And what about feminine hygiene supplies, shampoo, soap?
So pretty much whatever we got from the food bank was what we had. So, and especially being a program that focuses on...
Food bank?
Yeah, the food banks. So like food banks or churches would provide us with... just free food or rolls of toilet paper. And my understanding was that, if DHS is involved and they're placing these children, I would expect there'd be government funding for food, feminine products, shampoo, soap. But I come to realize if they can't even pay me a full paycheck, which at the time it was $9-$10 an hour, then how can they turn around and then buy these children shampoo and soap and feminine products? Like, they would come into the home at the other program. As soon as those children would come in the home, they were provided with a package, a care package, toothbrush, toothpaste, all the essentials. And then
at the place that you went to,
at the other placement that I moved on to. Mm-hmm. And at this one, sometimes the kids would come downstairs and ask for toothpaste, and they would tell them, well, you know what, the office didn't bring us anything, the food bank is all out, so you can either use baking soda or you can brush your teeth tomorrow. So it just, I wasn't raised like that, so these things were alarming to me, where the people, a lot of the people, staff working there might have been raised that way and didn't, there was no, it wasn't alarming to them. They just figured, well, these are the kids that nobody wants, so they're going to have to deal with it because they messed up in other placements, when it's not like that at all. It just, it's difficult.
So what would happen, did, were there ever inspections where DHS would come and look at the bathrooms or the sleeping quarters, or how did DHS respond if you said, no, you're not allowed to go upstairs or
well,
come inside?
Most of the workers that were interested in seeing the living conditions were not DHS workers. They were CASA workers or members of the community or other organizations that would hear the children's complaints and want to either validate or understand what was going on. The DHS workers in that program didn't come by much. I know that they had what they called wraparound visits. It was supposed to be every 30 or 90 days. But since I wasn't at that level, I didn't see those happen. And I didn't see them happen in the home. Maybe they were happening somewhere else. But, I mean, the complaints from the children, they were never getting met. They were not being heard. And they would tell us, and there wasn't much we could do for them.
And then when we talked before, you were talking about a time that you were disciplined related to your CPI training.
Yeah, so there was a house manager, and then there were all of us. And she was working with an individual who was schizophrenic bipolar, and she was restraining her to the point that she had climbed up on top of a dresser, and I was talking to her, can you please get down? You know, we'll work with you. What's going on? And the house manager comes in the room, and she was tired of it, and she grabs her off the top of the dresser, throws her on the ground, and the client, she bit her lip, so she was bleeding from her mouth, and she ordered me to help me hold down the child, which I was not going to do. And I told her, the manager, that is an incorrect hold. You need to let her go right now. And she wouldn't let go. She ordered me to hold her down, and I refused. Later, I was reprimanded for putting the other staff member, the manager, in danger when I tried to tell the case manager, well, I was concerned for the child because she was bleeding and the hold was incorrect, and the camera that was supposed to be in that room was taped over. So they installed cameras later on because there were so many accusations of abuse and neglect. But in some rooms, the cameras were taped over. And those, they made sure those were the rooms that the holds were carried out. So it just, I didn't understand why I was getting reprimanded for doing things that I thought morally shouldn't be done.
And I guess the last question that I had from what we talked about, could you talk a little bit about, in the female-specific home that you were in, the interaction between adult men and the female residents?
Well, there were no men that worked in the residential home for the women, for the girls. But they would go home with some of the workers. So they would, there were people that lived in Portland that worked in the homes. And if they needed to run home and grab something or go to a kid's birthday party, their friend's birthday party, they would just take the clients with them. And I thought, how strange, because they're not residential workers. We don't know what their background is. And you're exposing these children to things that they might have been taken out of their homes for. So how is that appropriate in any way? And they would say, oh, well, it's okay. They're a foster home at Give Us This Day. Or they used to work at Donald E. Longer. They're fine. But I just couldn't be a part of it. They would say, well, we're going to go to a picnic in the park. It's run by the city, and we'd show up, and it's a family barbecue. And it just, shady people. I mean, we went to a city-run barbecue. It was supposedly run by the city of Portland, and it wasn't. It was one of the foster parents' family barbecues, and they actually had a fight during... The family got in a fight during the barbecue, and I told the case manager, I was like, this is exactly why this is not appropriate. And how are we, now what are we going to do? Because these children, as a mob, were involved in this fight between adults that were family, not run by the city. It wasn't approved. So now what? And they said, well, we're going to alert DHS, this and that. And I don't know what, honestly, ever made it to DHS. I still don't know.
And was there ever a time that you talked directly to a DHS worker about your concerns in the facility?
There were times I talked to DHS workers, not at Rodney, or not at one of the homes for the girls, but for the boys. It was mainly they would place sex offenders or sexually abused boys in that home. And the concern of the DHS worker was they didn't have room for the girls in the girls' home, so they started placing girls in the boys' home. And the youngest girl placed in the boys' home was 8 years old, and the oldest male sexual offender was 17. So her question was, how is it that you can, I'm bringing a client, a male client, to a home for registered sex offenders, and there's a little girl here. So how does that work? And I told her, well, what they've told me is that they don't have placement anywhere else, so that she's just temporary because it's, since they take in emergency cases, they'll just place the kid where they have room for the night and then send them out to where they're going to stay. And that child ended up staying there for 3 months with her siblings, but it was also her sister and her brother. So they were young, and they were in a boys' home. It didn't make any sense. But I never, the DHS workers, they would ask questions, but there was no follow-up. There was no one coming around to ask questions later. No investigations, and I just, at the time I thought maybe this is just how horrible it can be. And then when I went on to work at the next program, I saw a lot of interaction with DHS and the children and their parole and probation. And I mean, I saw that no, in no way is Give Us This Day how anything, any child should ever live.
Thanks. Questions for Rachel?
Mm-hmm. How many clients were at this facility?
Which there were, they had at the time 4 homes. So at the home in Northeast Portland, there was a boys and a girls home. The boys home had 6 at the time, and the girls home, I mean, at its fullest, it was like 18. And there was, it was supposed to be staff 1 to every 3, unless there was a one-on-one, which one-on-one, again, didn't mean anything, just more funding. And I remember a time I was there from 6 a.m. to 1 p.m. with 12 clients, completely alone, because just nobody decided to show up. So in the girls' home, there was 15 pretty consistently, and then boys, about 7 or 8.
A follow-up? You had mentioned at this facility that you were working at, there was a fire on the second floor, and then there was mold on the third floor. Where did these clients sleep if that was?
Well, the third floor was completely sealed off. They removed the staircase because they had told us there was a fire in previous years that completely destroyed the upstairs, and they don't have money to get it fixed, which is concerning because we don't know what's up there. The second floor, there was mold in the bathrooms, there was mold in the corners, on the ceilings, and that's where they slept. That is where they slept. And they would, whenever they would have some type of worker, I'm not sure who would come in and check the home, but they would call us in the day before. You need to come in, wear clothes to clean, bring cleaning supplies, because we're going to completely clean out this home. Which, if it's my job, I'm going to get paid for it. I'm not going to go for free to help them cover the filth so that they can still receive funding. That's not, I'm not going to do that. So that's where they slept, on the second floor.
You've painted a pretty dismal condition for this building. Why wasn't DHS able to see through the smoke screen and look at this stuff? If they're putting people in there, why aren't they responsible to go in and check to make sure that the facility is adequate? Why didn't they do that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. If it happened, it happened when I wasn't there. But like I said, I was there 14 hours a day most of the time. They would come, bring the child. The child would unload their things into the, where we would have to inventory everything, and then the DHS worker would just sign and take off. So I think they trusted that maybe this program had it together like other programs did, when they are just really good at covering things up.
I think I'll save the rest of my questions for other folks.
All right. Thank you. Sanderson?
No, but I do thank you very much for coming to share this. I wish that this kind of conversation would have been happened maybe with the DHS, because I think probably some of this is probably new to them too.
Yeah, and that's I mean, there was a lot of push not to come just because a lot of people don't want to come forward, but I just feel like I should finish what I started.
And just one thing to follow up, because you were trying to do incident reports, what's the difference between the way that the, in terms of elevating the information to DHS? So as a 20-year-old, you were writing incident reports, you were talking to folks. What's different about the next program that you went to in terms of how that flow of information would go to DHS?
Yeah, so the next program I went to, their protocol was you write your own incident report, regardless if you can't spell very well or whatever. You just write it, you fax that to the DHS worker, and after you fax that, you take the copy and you put it on the therapist's desk. And so there's three copies, and then you put one in the shift log, so everybody knows what's going on at the same time. There's no rewriting, like at Give Us This Day, there would rewrite incident reports. And their claim was, well, some of the staff don't know how to spell, or some of the staff don't know how to word things. So we'll rewrite them for you, and we'll send them off, which made me really uncomfortable. So there was, everything had to go through this one case manager for the entire program. And she was the one who would pass along any information. And that was pretty much it. And the other program, everything was transparent. Everybody worked together. If something happened, something just small, everybody addressed it. The DHS worker was there, and they just took care of it right away.
So when you were there as a, so you said you were there for 3 years, so 20 to 23 years old, did you feel like you were doing what you needed to do to alert people to the concerning situations?
Yeah, well, sometimes I would just feel like maybe we can, they already have so many hard cases here, maybe we can mold this into something better. Maybe I can, I would have to spend my own money. I would use my own gas, my own transportation. So maybe it would just take some sacrifice to get this place back where it should be. And then I just realized that the problem is not with at the lower level. The problem is, you know, people aren't coming around to ask questions, so there's no support. And I talked to a lot of staff members before I came, and they just pretty much said, like, just give up. What? Who cares? Nobody's going to listen. Because this program has been in question before, and somehow they still keep getting clients. So,
thank you very much. Anything else before she takes off? No. And thank you again for coming. I know it was a difficult decision.
Thank you.
So next we've got Lois Day, John Thompson, and Tom Vanderveen. Please. Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director in the Department of Human Services.
Good morning. I'm Tom Vanderveen. I'm Deputy Director of the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, also with DHS.
And my name is John Thompson, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, known as OAPI.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do, the PowerPoint is now out of sync, so I'm just going to go to the slide that relates to this.
Very good.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I thought I would start talking about the types of placement just to give you some information, but I feel compelled really to acknowledge what the prior witness has said. That's the first time I've been able to hear what she experienced in this facility as an employee. It's very concerning. We really cannot have intermediaries between mandatory reporters in the department making decisions around what should come to us. We need direct contact with them. It's really not allowed in programs that someone rewrite incident reports and sign someone else's name. We're going to talk about the licensing and investigative process for facilities such as this. But I really need to speak directly with that witness and get more detail so that we can go back and look at what we have in our records for that period of time and try to reconcile what she is telling us with what our experience was with this program. So I want to assure the committee that we take it very seriously, and it's unacceptable.
Can I ask, though, because some of the information, Chris was really great to kind of send the emails over a period of time, and some of the incidents seem to match things that were shared with the department, like a child not having a bed to sleep on, or certain DHS workers not being allowed in the home, or the one-to-one hours not matching the number of hours in a day over many, many years. So I guess I'm just wondering, kind of going through all these people at DHS that had these concerns through licensing and OWAPI investigations, why wouldn't somebody go in and go to the second floor of the facility?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I can't tell you right now why someone wouldn't. I would expect they would. The issue of the fire is concerning. The fire marshal inspects these type of facilities every 2 years, so I don't understand how we could have a fire in a facility and not know that. So with the detail that hopefully that witness can provide me, we'll be able to go back and look at our records to determine where that disconnect is. And I know, I presume you all are aware that Director Weybrandt has directed for an internal review of our licensing and investigation processes, and this will greatly inform us in terms of matching time frames for what she was experiencing as an employee and what we were finding in our investigations and licensing.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
It sounded like from the discussion of the previous client, our previous witness, that you weren't there but every 90 days. And if that's the case, and there's such a discrepancy, is there a potential that a DHS employee was not doing their job?
Chair Gelser and Senator Olson, part of the information that the chair requested from the department was, what's the rate of face-to-face visits we had with children while at Give Us This Day? Caseworkers are to visit their children every 30 days, and we're currently compiling that information to determine if, in fact, we were not doing our face-to-face visits.
Follow-up? What would be the repercussions if you found out that the protocol wasn't followed?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, I think it depends upon what we find, honestly. We also provided the committee with our face-to-face contact numbers overall in child welfare, and we strive to do the every 30 days and during a certain period of time, and I don't know if it coincides with this time, we were at 60% staffing, which made it very difficult to do 100% face-to-face. Our expectation now is that 95% of the time we're doing those face-to-face visits every 30 days. Currently, I believe we're at about 80%, and the legislature a biennium ago provided us additional staff, and as we onboarded that staff, we were able to get to those visits more frequently.
Follow-up. In your face-to-face with the clients, do you ascertain nutritional values and general overall condition of the living facilities, or do you just go in and sit in a single room and chat with the client and leave?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, again, it depends. We have an expectation that children are seen in the home that they're placed in, as well as seen out in the community in case they are not comfortable, perhaps talking to us in the home in which they're placed. So it may be that for one face-to-face visit, the caseworker would take the child to another location, might see them in conjunction with a court hearing or with a visit that may occur at a DHS office. Another visit, they may see them in the home in which they are placed, and there is a requirement that, and I apologize I didn't bring this detail, but we can get it to you, and one of my staff may have it. There is a requirement for how often you need to see a child in the home in which they're placed. They could sit and have a conversation, but generally caseworkers ask them a broad range of questions around their well-being and condition and experiences and what's happening for them in their life. So they might not every time go upstairs to see their sleeping facility, but if a caseworker understood from a child that was placed that they were sleeping on the floor with no sheets in a moldy environment, my expectation would be that that caseworker would move further on that.
One follow-up, please. In your evaluation on the face-to-face, on your report form, is there any area in there that indicates the overall health and well-being of the child? In other words, are they clean? Do they appear to be well-fed, or do they look tattered and hungry? Is there anywhere in your form that is required to put that down as a report?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, there's not a form for the face-to-face visit. Face-to-face contacts are captured in what we call case notes, and workers are expected to ask a variety of questions to ascertain how the child is. Their appearance is certainly something a caseworker would note. If there was nothing unusual in their appearance, they may or may not write, "There's nothing unusual." But certainly if a child was not looking healthy, was not looking like their needs were being tended to, we would expect that to be documented in case notes.
So when there's information that goes to the central office about a child or about an issue, does that go to the caseworker? So kind of going through all the emails that Chris sent this weekend, there are things that are very similar to what Rachel said. We've got from Matthew Rasmussen, "I'm not clear why so much is requested during the work days. From my understanding, blank is in school every day, initially making it difficult to even achieve 9 hours a day. And from discussions with the caseworker, blank has expressed that blank has never seen a one-to-one when one goes to visit and was unaware that the person even had a one-on-one staff." There were letters from mental health providers saying that Give Us This Day was refusing to allow kids to be assessed or continue their therapy with therapists. I'm writing this because I've heard many times from mental health providers that Give Us This Day providers have prevented children from getting appropriate, necessary mental health services. I just heard that there is a youth in your care who has been sleeping on the couch and doesn't have a bed. Someone that's not background checked, being a foster care provider, nobody living in the foster home. All of those issues are there, medication errors, all of that stuff is there. Who is there a central place that looks at, wow, there's all of these concerns coming from all of these different places, but very significant concerns? How could that all happen and not have some sort of a change?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, it might be helpful if we take a little bit of time to talk about how investigations in facilities occur and the licensing process so that you get a picture of the intersection of those things. Mm-hmm. It's my belief that many of those things in there were addressed, and so I want them to talk a little bit about, my peers here, to talk a little bit about the process so that we have that foundation to talk from further. Great. Thank you.
So again, I'm Tom Vanderveen, Deputy Director, Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight. So I'll talk a little bit about the licensing process. In our office, we have three licensing coordinators which provide oversight to approximately 220 different programs across the state of Oregon. The types of programs that are licensed include eight different types: residential care, foster care, homeless runaway youth programs, private adoption agencies, day treatment, outdoor youth programs, therapeutic boarding schools, and academic boarding schools. The initial application coming from a license or an applicant who wants to get a license, they have to submit a number of items from their corporation documents, identify board members, staff list, org chart, budgetary information, specific policies and procedures, insurance, floor plans, if it's a facility-based criminal and child abuse background checks, and program and service descriptions and copies of other inspections, such as the fire marshal and sanitation inspection and other documents required from other inspectors. Our licensing coordinator would review that information. If all the documentation meets the licensing rule requirements, they would complete an on-site visit, and if successful, the applicant would receive a six-month license. At the end of that 6 months, additional information would be reviewed, which would include review of documentation of services being provided, interviews with the children in the facility, as well as interviews of staff. If they meet those requirements, then they would receive a license for 2 years, and a review would occur every 2 years following. So following each renewal visit, a report is written by the licensing coordinator, which provides a brief summary of the private agency and identifies strengths, recommendations, and any corrective actions resulting from noncompliance with applicable Oregon administrative rule. The licensing coordinator works with the private agency until the required actions are completed and the agency is back into compliance. If the agency is not in substantial compliance, the department will take action to revoke, suspend, or deny the license. And substantial compliance essentially means that a rule violation constitutes a danger to the health or safety of any individual, a willful or ongoing violation of the rights of children or families, or essentially the agency is preventing the accomplishments of the department's purpose. So that's the routine process of the licensing process. If at any point in between the every two-year visit a allegation of abuse or neglect is received, that is investigated and cross-reported to us from the Office of Adult Abuse and Prevention and Investigation, and the assigned licensing coordinator would review that report from the investigation. And if there were licensing rules that were violated in that, they would, in the same way that they would with the regular review, they would confirm that those issues have been corrected, or if they're not in substantial compliance, work towards revocation or denial. If allegations come in or complaints come in that are not related to abuse or neglect, the licensing coordinator would actually investigate those issues themselves, and again, ensure that the facility gets back into compliance or pursue revocation if it's substantially out of compliance.
Is it typical when you go out for these investigations or for the licensing visits for the provider that you're going to dictate who can or cannot come out on the licensing visit? I noticed in some of the correspondence there were specific requests. I don't want this person. They've been critical of the program before. There was an ERB complaint around an AWAPI person that was terminated because they sent somebody in that Give Us This Day did not want. There's a child welfare person. They felt like they were watching them, and they didn't ever want them in their facility. Is that ever a red flag?
So from a licensing perspective, the assigned licensing coordinator usually has a program for, you know, 3 or 4 years, and then there's a rotation amongst the staff to make sure that there's not, so that other folks have an opportunity to work with folks and we have a level of consistency and inter-rater reliability.
But is that typical? In this case, in at least two instances, based on the records from DHS, the provider agency said, we don't want this person from licensing or child welfare to be part of this review. We don't want them in our facility. Is it typical that the organization is allowed to say, this person has asked too many questions before, I don't want them here, and then to comply with that?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that's not routine. I believe that example might have been with a particular investigation of abuse or neglect. I'm not aware of that happening from a licensing perspective.
So it was in the emails in regards to the most recent licensing visit when one of the homes was changing to another provider, and there were a number of emails about this particular person that they did not want on the team. They did not want them, that person there, which was separate from this other individual in that a WAPI case. But it just, to me, having those two things coupled with Rachel, it seems like there's a pattern of we don't want DHS in our house or specific people that ask a lot of questions. And I just wonder how those kinds of requests are handled and if that might not raise some sort of a red flag.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, certainly that we're in a long-term relationship with agencies from a licensing perspective, and sometimes that can become adversarial. We need to accomplish the purposes of reviewing from a licensing perspective all the applicable rules, and we're going to pursue that action. If we can work around particular relationship issues, we'll do that. But bottom line, we need to confirm that licensing rules are being met.
So I guess I still didn't really hear an answer to the question. Would that be a red flag if on more than one occasion they're picking a person not to come in? And is that common practice to allow that licensee or individual that's being investigated for abuse to determine who their investigator is?
So from a licensing perspective, Chair Gelser and members of the committee, that is not a common practice. It would be a red flag to us as an agency if there's a particular problem with our staff as well as the private agency being licensed.
Chair Gelser.
Yes.
When you send your licensing and inspector out to look at the facility every 2 years, is there a requirement to have X number of beds per the clients that are in the building?
Yes, Chair or Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, that there is a requirement, a number of facility requirements in regards to square footage per resident, number of beds per resident, bathrooms, etc. And again, those would be requirements to meet the licensing rules.
Follow up. So when an investigator went out to look in the two-year span, he should be able to see bed frames in place, not mats. And you wouldn't count a mat as a bed, would you?
He would count the beds. And a mat or a mattress or a sleeping bag would not be considered. That would not meet the requirements of our rule.
Yeah, follow up. So that being the case, then, if, as we heard from our previous respondent, that there were just mats in this facility and not beds, wouldn't that raise a red flag?
Absolutely, it would.
So how did this red flag never get waived?
So I want to comment, as Lois did, I sincerely appreciate that Rachel came forward. I think that's very important. And I think we need to take a look at the details that she brought forward and determine what happened.
I'm still kind of hung up on how it's the first time. I mean, this is November 22nd, 2013, from Tom Height. There's a youth in your facility who's been sleeping on a couch and does not have a bed. I mean, it seems that the department knew.
If I could respond just for a minute, Chair Gelser, clearly you have an email that says we knew at that point in time one of the children was alleged to be sleeping on a couch. And what I hope to have the opportunity to do is match that time frame with the time frame that the prior witness said this was going on to see exactly what we did do. That would be a licensing violation. I'm hoping that what happened was that licensing was able to go out and determine that there were adequate beds for all of the children that were in the facility, which would be then, that's what we need to check. So it would not be acceptable for them to be sleeping on mats, Vice Chair Olson. It would not be acceptable for children to be sleeping without sheets and in mold. And I really, really want the opportunity to cross her experience time-wise with what we did know, because as you've pointed out, Chair Gelser, there's been quite a few interactions between the department and this program. So her being willing to come forward is really important for us to check what happened in our system, if in fact that was going on, but we were unable to uncover it in our processes. Thank you.
We're not certain, at least I'm not certain in my mind, when the fire took place at this facility. Would the fire marshal notify you that there was a fire there, and then you would subsequently come back and recheck for repair?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, members of the committee, that's exactly correct. That's what I would expect would happen. Something as significant as a fire would, in my experience, be included in the report from the fire marshal, and that there would be expectations for repairs to occur. But that wasn't the case in this example is concerning to me, and I would like to understand better what happened.
Thank you.
John, would you speak to investigations, please?
Chair, Senator Gelser, members of the committee, my name is John Thompson. Again, for the record, I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. The process of responding to an allegation of abuse in a CCP, which is shorthand for children's care provider, which covers the kind of setting that we're discussing here, is outlined in the administrative rules. And CCPs and their staff are considered mandatory reporters of abuse, negligent treatment, and maltreatment as defined in that rule. They're expected to report that to a child welfare hotline. Once the hotline staff makes the determination that the allegation involves a child placed in a CCP, then those referrals are sent to our office. They're actually pended internally in a computer system, so there's no actual transfer of a piece of paper. It happens electronically. At that point, there's a in-depth screening process that happens to review the allegation. There are also several layers of notifications that are triggered. They're set out in the rule as well. All referrals are cross-reported to law enforcement, also to excuse me, I'm a stutterer, and I was doing pretty well there, but I got stuck. They're cross-reported to ORO as well.
Is ORO?
Oh, I'm sorry, that's Tom's office, the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight. So after that cross-reporting happens, there's a process of ensuring that the CCP is assessing the safety of the children in their care, taking any action necessary to either remove them from whatever the risk is, ensure their ongoing safety. We work together with OLRO and Child Welfare to coordinate on the response to an allegation, determine, you know, at what level the response should occur, whether it's grave enough to require removal of children, which is not common but does occur, and it's a cross-agency process where the allegation is assessed and the proper response determined. So once it's been screened, that rule allows for an in-depth screening process, which can actually involve interviews with involved parties. It can even involve a visit to the site and the gathering of documentation. If after screening, OWAPI determines that the incident meets the relevant OAR administrative rule definition of abuse, negligent treatment, or maltreatment, and I can define those a little bit later if you like, then an investigation is assigned to one of our investigators. We're a shared service. We provide abuse-related services to many programs. Some of it is training and oversight of their own investigators. We also have our own team of investigators that that do investigations. And these investigations, the CCP allegations, are investigated by OWAP staff.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may interrupt a moment.
Yes.
You mentioned the rules that you have to set up for the allegations.
Yes,
is the bar very high or is it very low?
The center bar, whether it's determined to require an investigation.
Right. Is that bar difficult to attain? You have to have a huge amount of evidence, or is it very low to say that someone comes in and says they're abusing this child? Will you then open a case and go look?
Sure. Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, that is part of the art, if you will, of screening allegations. The definitions are written, generally speaking, to describe some behaviors which would constitute negligence or maltreatment, and there is a threshold of risk which has to be met. There has to be...
Is that threshold low or is it high?
It is stated as likely to endanger the child's health or welfare. So what our screener has to do is examine the facts of the allegation, determine whether the risk presented, either the behavior clearly met, the definition was an improper hold or something like that, or whatever happened was likely to endanger their health or welfare. And in some cases, you know, we tend to err on the side of, there is a tendency to err on the side of assigning for investigation, simply because it's better safe than sorry. However, that's balanced with the fact that we've encouraged CCPs to report quite a bit. And part of that reporting happens as a matter of trust that if they report something that they're not sure whether it meets the definition or not, that we're not automatically going to assign for an investigation. We're going to apply judgment to it and determine whether it needs to be assigned or not.
And we do have one of the other items on the agenda is going back and looking specifically at screening in that bar. And so I'm wondering if we can move back to this item. I know we've got a lot on the agenda and a lot of people in the room.
Sure. So just briefly, once it's assigned for investigation, we have a group of 15 investigators. About five of them are essentially specialized in this kind of investigation, along with parallel ones. And they start the process. They have 30 days to complete an investigation, write a report. At that point, we share the report and the outcome as required by the rule, part of which is reporting back to the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight on the outcome for their review and possible regulatory action. If the reports are screened, closed at screening and not assigned for investigation, there's a series of notifications that happens there as well. So law enforcement and other involved parties are advised that no further investigation will occur as specified in the rule.
So do you know one of the questions that we sent to DHS last week, what was the number of allegations of abuse that you've received, forgive us this day, over the last 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
How many were investigated and how many were substantiated?
So in the period of 2012, 2013, and 2014, we're still gathering information. Of course, we don't have complete data on 2015 yet. We received, through the Child Welfare Hotline, 76 allegations of alleged abuse, negligent treatment, or maltreatment. 29 of those, or around 38%, were assigned for investigation. 47 were not. Of the 29 that were assigned for investigation, two allegations were substantiated. And that's around 7% substantiation rate.
And were the others unsubstantiated or unable to substantiate? And was it a matter of the reporter was wrong and there was nothing bad happening, or it didn't meet the statutory definition of abuse?
It could be all of those things. I don't know case by case. I have not yet drilled down to get the exact outcome on each case. Generally speaking, we have three options: substantiate, not substantiated, or inconclusive. Inconclusive just means that after a complete investigation, the preponderance of the evidence, you know, it's right on the balance. It can't tip one way or the other. We try to continue investigating through those to find that piece of evidence that helps make us make that call. But sometimes, you know, there's truly not enough evidence to make a call. I don't have with me how many of the ones that were not substantiated were inconclusive and how many were not substantiated, but I can get that for you.
Great. And then one other question. In that 76 allegations, was that just about the four group homes, or is that inclusive of the foster homes that are?
Senator Gelser, that's inclusive of the foster homes that give us this day, does the certification process for. So it covers all the facilities that they have involvement with.
So in general, for other programs, a foster care home that's licensed through the department, that investigation would be done by child welfare.
Correct.
But if it's through an agency, then it goes through OWAPI.
Correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, yes. Is this 76 cases in that time frame, is this an inordinate amount of cases, or is it relative to everybody else? Does everybody else have about the same amount of cases come
right
forward?
That's a great question. Senator Olson, members of the committee, excuse me, we have looked at that. Because of the variety of CCPs, their size, the way they're set up, it's challenging to find one apple and compare it to another apple of the same type. However, we've done the best that we can there, and we've concluded that during this three-year time period, they were not we were not receiving a disproportionate number of referrals from those sites. It was very much in line with some other providers of the same size. So it was not standing out in that regard in terms of the volume of referrals that we received.
Thank you. So questions, any other questions for this panel before we move on to the next one? I have one. Again, kind of reading through the materials and the licensing, the program was relicensed under a different license last year to move from one type of a facility to a, really from a licensed foster home to a licensed group facility or residential home. And in that correspondence and that initial licensing, like the majority of the requirements weren't met, and licensing worked with them to meet them. It was acknowledged that there were garnishments for payments, that staff were going unpaid, that the agency was filing for bankruptcy, that there were liens and garnishments from the IRS, that there were issues with BOLI. Given all of those things, does that come into play at all when looking at licensing a facility? If they're telling you, we're about to file for bankruptcy, we can't pay our staff, and all these agencies are coming after us for our unpaid bills and unpaid staff. And
so, Chair Gelser and members of the committee, our primary guideline is the statute and the Oregon administrative rules that are applicable to the licensed entity. Certainly, we're not going to take a blind approach to anything else. So those issues, those concerns were certainly aware to us, and as we did our routine review, we incorporated that information to look at applicable rules. But many of those items are not specifically prohibited in our licensing rules, but they would be of concern to us.
And how many children are there today in the group homes and the foster homes?
Chair Gelster, members of the committee, are you speaking in this program?
Yes.
I believe there are 26 in foster homes only. There's no residential facility open at this time.
And how? What changed to cause that to occur, given that the license just changed a year ago for one of the facilities?
Chair Gelser, I don't know why that facility, why they stopped that particular service delivery model, but they did move to foster homes only. And these foster homes are certified by Give Us This Day. They're not DHS foster homes.
Gelser. Are you saying that financial liquidity and financial stability are not a requirement to meet the licensing?
Senator Olson, members of the committee, there are specific financial rules that are required. They're rather broad. They're required to have a budget. They're required to be insured, and required to meet general accounting principles. However, specific liquidity is not identified in the rule. It's fairly broad. There may be an opportunity to partner with the Department of Justice. They had we've had some conversations about an exception that's in statute in regards to their review of our private child caring agencies, and they don't look at some of those right now, and that's by statute. We've had conversations about potentially taking a look at that statute and putting some proposals together to increase accountability in regards to some of those details.
Madam Chair, we get greater scrutiny getting a car loan because they want to look at my income. They want to look at my liquidity. They look at my credit rating. Obviously, this is not a part of the licensing process. So we're putting children into a facility that can't afford to feed them, can't afford to pay staff. To me, that would be paramount as a part of the licensing program. Is this facility is this financially solvent so that it can take care of these kids in the way they should be taken care of? Instead of writing a budget, hell, anybody can write a budget. That doesn't mean you're going to meet the budget. That doesn't mean you have the financial ability to meet the budget and take care of these children. And obviously, it sounds like they're living on a day-to-day basis. You give them a check, and they're able to get bills through for a couple of weeks, and then they fall into problem again. That doesn't sound like a very operative way to run a licensing program.
Chair Gelser and Senator Olson, I agree with your comments. We have a variety of providers that have varying levels of business expertise. And I would say, in my experience, most have better business expertise than this particular program did in managing the flow of their funds. I believe, Chair Gelser, I'm not positive that you requested how much we had paid this program over time. And so we provided that and believe that to be adequate in terms of supporting the children in their care, as well as the services that were needed and contracted for. And it's clear, I think, from the information you have, that they struggled with their business model. We're looking at, as Tom just said, at what is the how much expertise can we bring to bear on programs evaluating just what you said, their financial liquidity and their ability to manage the complexities of the program financially. So it's a concern to us. This is a program that clearly struggled with that. We worked with them around that, and I think they were not good at it. That is what it appears to us. We would support a more stringent look at residential programs around their financial ability to manage the programs.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I just find it unbelievable. I'm new to this committee, and I've been on since last year, or actually this year, the long session. It just amazes me that DHS has been around for years and years and years and years, and no one has ever taken the time to say, are they solvent? You don't have any rules to dictate whether a business can stay in business. A lot of businesses start and a lot of businesses fail. And that's part of the criteria when a bank loans money. Is this business going to make it? Do they have the financial ability to get through? Do they have the expertise to get through? And if that's not part of your licensing process and your business model, I don't get it. I don't understand it, because you're dealing with children's lives. We're giving out hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you don't really care. They have a budget. They have insurance. They have whatever your third criteria was. It doesn't make sense to me that an agency your size who has a budget can't figure out whether a person is going to meet the budget that they put forward. And I don't see why you don't have rules for that.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, as Tom explained, we do have rules, and part of our review that Director Labrant has said will occur, we are looking specifically at that issue. Are they stringent enough? Do we have the expertise on staff to actually evaluate liquidity, financial liquidity of a program? And if not, what do we need to put in place in order to do that? Tom also mentioned that we've been in conversation with the Department of Justice around a particular exception that's in statute that exempts from, and I might get this not quite right, but I believe what it does is it exempts from the review by DOJ of nonprofit organizations those that are contracted for by the Department of Human Services. And I haven't been able to ascertain why that is, but we're in conversation with them around whether or not that exception should even be there.
And will you get back to us with that sooner rather than later if we need to act in February on that issue? And if there's other statutory barriers that are in the way, I think just from observation, sometimes it seems like DHS is hampered by rules, sometimes hampered by statute, and it's frustrating because there's a common sense lens that somehow the statute prevents. So if that's the case in any of these things, the sooner you can let us know about that, the better, so we can get that out of your way.
Chair Gelser, I really appreciate that, because our rules are written to help us function under the statute. So as we identify those, I appreciate your willingness for us to bring them forward.
Anything else on
this?
Just
one question. Yes. Do we have enough homes to meet the need? Is it hard to get adequate homes for our children?
Chair Gelser, Senator Moniz Anderson, the simple answer is no. And the reason is because we may have enough in number, but our system is safer and more functional if we have more homes than are needed, given the number of children that need the service. Because what we want to be able to do when a child comes into care is match that child's needs with the home that can best meet them, and not just have enough homes. So if you count homes and the number of certified slots, both for homes, family foster homes and residential, although I'll say for family foster homes first, if it was just a number, then yes. But in terms of the practice and what best meets children's needs, the answer is no. And we work with, we have people that help us recruit homes. We have staff that works on recruitment, retention, training for those foster homes. When we move into residential settings behavior rehabilitation services, we don't have enough slots for the needs of the kids that are coming into our custody, and we're always working to increase those, and again, to make sure that what we're creating matches the needs of the children that come into the system. This particular facility was a shelter. It was not a treatment facility, and designed for children to come in and then move to a more appropriate placement when there was somewhere to move to. And that is a critical link in our system that we really are focusing on right now. We're in conversation with the providers around how can we design the system to better meet the needs of those kids that need that higher level of service, in hopes of having services more available, more slots, and more accessible, perhaps even in the home the child is residing, rather than a move to a different facility.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. So we're going to bounce around a little bit, because we've got some folks that are here from outside the building. So we're going to go back up to the second item, which was the interaction between family court, public safety. So Lois gets to stay. Sorry, Lois. And then the Honorable Lindsay Partridge and Amy Miller, please.
Chair Gilsoy, as they're coming to the table,
yes.
Can I just make one comment? I just want to speak a moment about quality assurance in Chihuahua, because I think what we're going to do is move into several areas of our practice and want to be able to talk about how are we going to be able to assure quality even when we make changes. And so at some point, and this may not be the point, I'd like the opportunity to talk about what
Absolutely.
We're looking forward to as well as what we have now.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking that'll fit in really well. And we're using the wrong word, kind of that audit, but that is that when you're looking at, you're identifying issues, where are you moving next? Is that okay if we do that at that point?
Chair Gilsoy, so that would be great. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, great. But I promise we will get to that.
Madam Chair, at yes. some point in time, and I know we haven't really got to it, you know, it's what information they're able to get. And because I mean, we run into HIPAA and we run into a few other things here as far as, but I'm assuming even with HIPAA that the encounter data, you don't know what's going on inside, but you know that something, that an appointment happened. And I think that is, you still have that level of information or not?
Chair Gelser, Senator Cruz, I provided the, not certain I understand your question, but we can do de-identified aggregate data.
Right.
I provided the committee with a 3-page summary of all the rules and statutes, state and federal, that come into consideration when we're talking about release of court records, child welfare assessments, and child welfare records. And we can have a conversation about that.
Okay. Because, I mean, to a degree, we end up with... You can share data in a closed system, and you can't share it outside the closed system. So the question is the system large enough for the data to actually exist where it needs to? So,
and I think that's part of the question, too, overall, is how do we create a system where we're protecting the confidentiality mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. clients, but we aren't protecting it so much that there's a darkness that we can't see. And I think a comparison in, I was really surprised to learn about the difference between the adult records, for instance, when OWAPI does an investigation of an adult foster home or residential home, you can go over to DHS and ask for the redacted copies. You can read the entire investigation report. You can kind of see what that history is, but you can't do that in child welfare. We probably should be able to do, not in a family home, but in a state-paid licensed facility, that probably should be redacted public information.
Chair Gelser, this may be an area, again, where we have some legislative solution. I don't know at this point, but I think that conversation would be very welcome.
Thank you very much. All right, so we're taking a little bit of a shift in the order of the agenda. So this item is looking at when you have circumstances of families can be complicated. So you may have a family that is in multiple counties, and there is a child abuse investigation going on. Maybe a parent hypothetically has been convicted of a crime related to that abuse, and yet in another county altogether, there may be a child custody battle going on. And it seems that not all of that information always flows. So the point of this topic is, how do these systems talk to each other when making decisions concurrently about where kids are living when these systems are kind of separate from each other?
So, Chair Gelson, members of the committee, as a point of order, do I have to keep identifying myself if I'm not leaving the table?
New topic, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
It's for those on the team.
Members of the committee, for the record.
Lois, we may forget who you are. So.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. My name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director of the Department of Human Services, and maybe we can have everyone introduce themselves and then speak to the topic.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Amy Miller. Thank you. I'm Deputy General Counsel at the Office of Public Defense Services.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Partridge, Marion County Circuit Court Judge, currently presiding juvenile court judge in Marion County.
Thank you.
Chair Gelsel, members of the committee, I am going to allow my colleagues to speak first, since this really is referencing, I believe, how the court systems, the various cases that can come in front of a court, inform each other and how they inform each other across county lines when they may not be in the same, when cases may not be in the same county. Child welfare will respond to any court order for records, and we may ask for an in-camera review to ensure that information that isn't releasable is not released. We get a lot of reports in our system that go into a specific file about a family that may not be germane to the issue in the court that's asking for them. And there are some tests written into the statute that at times allows us to release information if certain conditions exist. If one of those is the statute we're attempting to release under, then we'll ask, the judge will generally ask us questions that will establish that the exception has been met so that we can actually release the information. But I'll let them inform you of the court system. Thank you.
Maybe I'll take over, probably mainly because Lois needs a break anyway. I prepared some written remarks. I think they've just been handed out to the committee. First of all, I want to say, before it goes in the official record, I'd like to be able to proofread a couple of things. I did this late last night. My mother, who's a retired English teacher, would be very disappointed in me if it went in the current form. But at least for the purposes of what we're going to do here this morning, I think it'll give you hopefully some background information. I wasn't sure exactly what the committee was looking for regarding this topic, so I tried to broad brush many different areas. If you're like me, when I'm on the bench and somebody has given me written materials, the last thing you want is somebody to sit and read to you what they've already written. I'm very happy to respond to any type of inquiries that you might have at the outset so I can get to what you want and you can get on with your agenda.
So I think a really specific question would be, so you are a presiding juvenile court judge. There's a divorce custody order going on. Sometimes people are representing themselves.
Most of the time.
Are you automatically searching for child welfare records, or is it dependent upon the parties in the case to bring that to your attention? If it's, so maybe you're in E-Court, another county is not. How do we ensure that those child welfare records are part of a custody determination?
Well, the first thing that I can tell you is in July of 2016, we're going to be in a much better position than we are today because our Odyssey system will have been implemented all across the state. Currently, I heard Mr. Lemon told us about, we're about two-thirds of the way through. So right now, we're now in Odyssey County. If I have a case before me, I can run a name of one of the litigants in the system, and anything they have statewide, as long as it's an Odyssey County, will come to my attention. If it's an Ogden County, our old system, unfortunately, it won't. So we're kind of in a never-never land right now, but it will be resolved. So that will help us greatly, and it's one of the huge advantages to the Odyssey system coming on board from my perspective. And I guess, while I speak of my perspective, I want to make it clear, as I'm sure you probably know, that I'm only here speaking on my behalf, not on behalf of any other judge or the Oregon Judicial Department.
Not all judges agree on everything all the time?
No. And that
they were just like the legislature.
That's
that
what
way,
makes it so fun, right? If we all agreed, that wouldn't be very fun. But we all know we're right, though. That's what's important. So the other way in which we find out about these cases is that if you have a dependency case and a petition is filed, that petition requires that the address of the children for the last 5 years, not the address, I'm sorry, the residence of the children is listed. So you can see from the get-go in a case on a petition that you may have had over the last 5 years children living in other counties. And so as the process goes on and we're looking at some point closing a case, at least in my perspective, I'm looking at that and saying, okay, if we close our case, who has custody, what are the visitation rights of the other parent, and I'm clued into that by the paperwork to begin with, but also generally the parties are providing that information as well, and we're aware of that. While the juvenile case is open, it's really not that critical because the juvenile case trumps everything else. So even though you have a custody case that has been decided, whether it's in my county or another county, 5 years ago, once a juvenile case is filed and the court takes jurisdiction or temporary jurisdiction, it trumps whatever that custody and visitation is. So when we look to get out of the case at some point, then we know that that's an issue that needs to be addressed in many cases. If it is a case where it's out of county, there's a procedure by which a modification of that can be transferred to my county, be consolidated with my juvenile case, and the transfer of the domestic relations piece is more problematic because generally we have pro se clients. They will need to initiate something in the original county. Our attorneys, and I'll let Amy speak a little bit about how the attorneys influence this process. So we always have attorneys for parents and children in the dependency case. They may be in a situation where they have given some direction to their client about how to get that domestic relations case down, but still it can be a daunting process. I will say, before I was on the bench, I did juvenile court representation, and sometimes, frankly, I just did the motion myself because it was easier to do that to get things moving. But certainly that's not an expectation that we have for attorneys. So that's one issue. A criminal case is a little bit more difficult to consolidate. If it's in the same county, if it's in Marion County, generally we will try to consolidate a juvenile dependency case and a criminal case and maybe a pending domestic relations case if it involves issues that are going to impact child custody. Now, if the parent has a theft too or something, probably not going to do that. But if it is a criminal mistreatment case, some type of drug case, certainly any type of sex offense, some type of person offense, we'll try to do that so that one judge has all those cases. It's more problematic if that criminal case is in another county because you can't bring the criminal case from Clackamas County to Marion County. That criminal case needs to be litigated and prosecuted in the county in which the crime's alleged to have occurred. But generally, we would be aware in Marion County that that case is proceeding. And usually we would not end the dependency case or a domestic relations case until there was some finality to the criminal case so we know what the outcome of that was. So I'm not sure,
so Senator, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say hypothetically there was a case in Curry County, and there was an event that led to a kid getting hurt. The alleged abuser is arrested and charged and convicted, but there is another parent that might be available, so there is no dependency case filed because there's someplace else for the kid to go. Mm-hmm. But that domestic relations case isn't yet settled in a different county, like Malheur County. That discussion continues. How does the fact of any criminal conviction or protective order make it to the custody judge in the other county so that is taken into consideration? Is that entirely up to the parents who are representing themselves, or will the new court system make sure that all of that information is there for the consideration of the court?
Generally, it would be up to the other party, the non-convicted parent, to bring that to the court's attention. If parents are represented, certainly that's going to happen. If they're pro se, generally it's going to happen, because if there's a dispute over the custody situation, then certainly one side's trying to prevent or present as much damaging evidence as they can against the other party. Where that might become a problem is a case where even though parents are divorcing, or maybe they're not divorced, but they're pursuing custody, and for some reason they don't want the court to know about that. I can't say I've ever seen that. I can imagine a scenario where it might. Once we're on Odyssey, it would be very, once all counties are on Odyssey, it'd be very easy to figure that out. And frankly, if what was predominating my calendar was the custody case and I had to make a decision about custody, I would probably go into Odyssey and want to be aware of whatever's in the court record. So I would probably be aware of that and certainly ask about it. But it wouldn't be...
Is that something by procedure that you're required to do, or is that just what you do out of due diligence?
That's what I would do. I don't know that there's some mandate that I'm required to do that. And I would think most judges that do child custody cases would do that if they had that option. But I've never seen that, Senator, where the other parent wouldn't be more than happy to bring that information to my attention.
And then just one question as a matter of law, and then we'll move on to the next person. What happens when there's two judges that give competing orders? So one judge in one county might order custody to one parent, and a judge in another county has issued a protective order that doesn't allow a parent to see the subject child. Which order takes precedence?
Well, the protective order should be filed in the county where there's a previous judgment. So it should be in the same county. I'm not understanding a scenario where there'd be two different counties. In our county, if there was already a domestic relations case, someone came and asked for a protective order, it would be assigned to the judge that had the original domestic relations case.
No, but if the protective order came out of a criminal case?
Oh, as like a condition of probation? Let me think about that for a second. The issue with that would be while the parent is on the criminal probation, if there's a no contact order, that would supersede whatever was done in the domestic relations case, because while the parent might be able to have contact with the child through the domestic relations case, they would do that at the peril of violating their probation and going to jail or prison potentially. But would judges confer on that situation in making that decision? Typically not.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I don't have any prepared remarks, but I'm here to answer questions if you have any. The Office of Public Defense Services contracts with attorneys who represent parents and children in juvenile dependency cases. And the majority of our contracts are county-specific, so that I think the questions that you're asking may be outside of something that I can speak to. But if you do have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. Any questions? No. But it sounds like kind of the move to eCourt will help have better flow of information, so it would be easier to see what's happening comprehensively with a family or an individual rather than having to pick up and call every county to say, hey, do you have anything on this person?
It should be, and particularly if we have a dependency case involved, caseworker is going to know about that information. One of the attorneys are going to know about it. It's going to come to the court's attention, and we're going to address that. The one glitch, if you may, Senator, would be the scenario in which you've identified where you have the criminal case and then a domestic relations case in another county. If it was a dependency case that was in another county, certainly we'd know about the criminal case and would probably look to have the dependency case consolidated where the criminal case was, but not always. And by statute, the dependency case can be transferred between counties if the judges confer. We do that quite often. I don't think I've ever had a disagreement with a judge about a consolidation issue, because we are looking to see the services in particular that are going to flow to the family and the children, what's going to be most convenient. We listen a lot to DHS about what they think they can most effectively provide services to, and generally that's what they follow. Before I leave, can I just address a couple issues that are burning based on your earlier discussion?
Yes.
And first of all, I want to say I don't know anything about the situation that you're referring to with the particular program up in Portland. But I do know, as a judge and an attorney, that one of the things that hasn't been mentioned is, at least in Marion County and maybe statewide now, every attorney or every child in foster care is appointed counsel. And they have counsel. The expectation, at least in my county, is that the attorneys will meet with their clients, and they'll be going out to where the child resides and seeing the condition in which they're living in. I don't know anything about what happened or didn't happen in this particular case. And they're going there, and they're, you know, I know from personal experience, you're going in, you're looking to see where the kids sleep, you're talking to the kids, having different information, and then if there's concerns about that, if they rise to the level of a child abuse reporting, I've certainly seen cases where that's occurred, but if it's maybe not rising that level, but it's concerning, attorneys are talking with caseworkers and supervisors and bringing it up to the court. If I became aware of some of those conditions as a juvenile court judge and was hearing about it, first thing is I would step back and say, well, just because I hear that testimony doesn't necessarily make it true. But there would be enough concern that the judge is going to be contacting, well, at least I would be contacting our branch manager and saying, hey, this is what I'm hearing. You need to check this out. So that's a piece when you're talking about the investigation of these complaints that also exists. Lastly, I guess what I want to say is that, Senator Olson, I share your concerns that I'm hearing your voicing. My concern is, where do we put these kids? I mean, it's easy to shut down a program. It's hard to find a placement for them. And I know that day in and day out. And these cases, we're talking about really difficult cases. I don't have the answer to it, but I know that we're often in a crisis situation where we have to make a decision right away, and we do not have good options for those kids. And usually they're kids that have suffered the most trauma. They need the most help to overcome that trauma, it's a very difficult population for a foster program, a foster parent to take on these kids. And the folks that do it and do it well, which is the vast majority of them, you know, God bless them, because I don't think I could do it. I'd much rather do my job than their job. So anyway, I just wanted to leave you with that information.
And I think that's an excellent point. And I think Senator Mona Sanderson was raising that as well, that the catch in all of it is, I think we have to make sure, and I think that's where that oversight piece comes in, even when it's hard and there aren't good options, we have to make sure that lack of capacity doesn't lead to a lowering of standards for the kids that probably need more protection than anybody else. And it is tricky, because they're kids that are tough and they need a lot, and there probably needs to be a lot of training and support to help these kids heal from what they've been through and get ready to have a successful adulthood.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Chair Gelser,
yes.
If I may comment on Judge Partridge's comment, our attorneys are guided by the Oregon State Bar Performance Standards, and there are specific standards called out for attorneys representing parents, and there are distinct standards called out for attorneys representing children. And those standards were just revised and approved by the Board of Governors last summer, and they're very, very thorough. Gosh, the document is 50, 60, 70 pages long, with a whole lot of information and guidance, but they require that attorneys meet with child clients within 72 hours of appointment, meet with them every quarter or when there's a significant change in circumstances, and continue to do ongoing independent investigation throughout the life of the case. And so attorneys should be very involved with these cases as well.
And just a question with that 72-hour time period, I'm thinking about something Lois said about this particular organization and these group homes as being more of shelter facilities where kids are in and out relatively quickly. Could that become a challenge in that within 72 hours if you're in shelter care briefly and then you're moving on to that next place? Could that create a loss of oversight just because of the timeline?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, certainly it's trickier when there's a lot of movement occurring, but I could speak to my experience, which was as a juvenile attorney up in Multnomah County. The DHS caseworker was most of the time very well prepared to give you contact information for your juvenile client, and oftentimes they were present in court as well. And so you have an opportunity to connect with them right away and have current information for them. And so from that point forward, would be able to make that connection.
I guess the question being in terms of going in and visiting the place that a child is living within 72 hours, if the child goes into shelter care and they're there for 48 hours, I mean, it's possible that one could meet that standard where you have a lot of turnover of the kids that are in those beds. And I'm just thinking about that in terms of the face-to-face visits as well. A face-to-face visit might occur, but not while the child is in that place if the child is kind of transient through a shelter. Is my thought making sense, Lois?
Or are they not? Chair Gelser, members of the committee, it's my understanding that caseworkers are present at the placement in residential facilities. So that I think that they have the opportunity to see that facility. I'm not clear on how often the court-appointed attorneys have the ability to see the facility if a child does have a 72-hour turnaround in a move. Many of the children who went into that particular facility, Give Us This Day, came from other placements and were there awaiting or, you know, that was a pause until there was an appropriate residential treatment placement available. But I believe you have pointed out perhaps a gap for us to look at. Thank you. Could I ask one question? Because I don't know the answer. Is there a role, or what is the role of juvenile court-appointed counsel for children in domestic relations situations, if any?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that's a good question, Lois. Our office contracts with attorneys who represent parents and children in juvenile court cases. There is no statutory right to counsel in domestic relations cases. And so to the extent that attorneys would be appointed to represent a child in a domestic relations case, that is not something that our office contracts for. I do know that I did, in preparation for this hearing, look at the statute in domestic relations cases. And 107.425 does permit the court to make that appointment. However, it indicates that a reasonable fee for an attorney may be charged against one or more of the parties or as a cost in the proceeding, but shall not be charged against funds appropriated for public defense services. So it can be handled independently, but it's not something that's handled through our office.
Great. And Senator, from my perspective, that's very rare that occurs because it's very limited funds. When I was doing a different calendar other than juvenile calendar, it would be about once a year in a case that we would do that. And usually because there's exceptional circumstances in that case.
Great. Thank you very, very much. We appreciate anything else before we excuse this panel. All right. Okay, we are going to skip ahead. We're going to give Lois a break. So let's go back to the cross-reporting of abuse. So we'd like Detective Mitch France, David Mandel, and Don Erickson, please.
If it's okay with the committee, I'd also like to bring up Kathleen Hines, our Director of Legal Compliance for the Office of Child Care.
Sounds great. And you can stay or go get a drink.
Thank you. I have my water. I do have some information, and I'll step back and allow these folks, and then I'll come forward with the
And if you prefer to go first, that's fine. I'm just conscious that you've been there for a long time.
Thank you.
Give you a chance to breathe.
I anticipate I took the best seat next to this, so that I anticipated I'd be here quite a bit. But I'll allow them to do that, and then I will come back to the table. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. Welcome. And do we have Don Erickson here too? Yeah. Great. So I'm sure that when Lois comes back, I am taking you all out of order. She's going to talk about the process of reporting and the cross-reporting. But the reason that we had invited all of you, there's two types of cross-reporting. Type of cross-reporting that the detective will talk about first, where a report comes in and it goes to law enforcement, goes to DHS, and they cross-report to each other. But then there's the issue of how, when the department becomes aware of abuse, how that information translates within the department to other agencies. So, for instance, if there is someone that loses their child care license for abuse or safety issues, what are the barriers that keep that person from going to be a direct care provider for adults with developmental disabilities or to be hired as a teacher? If child welfare substantiates an allegation of abuse and there's a dependency case where a parent loses their children, what if they are a child care provider? Do they maintain their child care license? So that's part of that second part. But we'll start with Detective France. You had kind of clued me into some of the cross-reporting issues, and I just hoped you could talk a little bit about the role of law enforcement and those interactions with DHS to keep kids safe, and recommendations that you have of how we can do better.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So my name is Mitch France. I'm a detective, just small agency over on the coast in Newport. I got introduced to child, well, obviously all officers do child abuse and neglect cases, but I got into the more finer points of it once I became a detective and sat on our MDTR multidisciplinary teams. The basic idea of how a cross report would come in, it would come in as a report of one or two ways, either directly to a police department through somebody calling in an abuse or a neglect situation, but mostly it comes in through the DHS cross reports. It goes to the DHS screening call or call screenings. And so for like Lincoln County, ours is actually combined, I think, with Lynn and Benton. And so it's a multi-office. They will take in a call from a concerned person. Usually it's going to be either a disgruntled family member of some sort, or it's going to be a mandatory reporter. Let's say it's a teacher says, Johnny comes to school and he's got a black eye. Kid's not real forthcoming about how that happens. They can't tell if it's abuse or not, so they call it into the DHS hotline. The hotline then takes the call and either determines if it's going to be responded to by DHS or not, and then they also then cross-report it to me. Once we get it, our department has set up. My biggest fear was that at one point all the cross-reports came solely to the detectives in my department, and then they were looked over. Well, my fear was at one point I became the only detective in the department, and while we were short-staffed, and I was afraid I'd take a long weekend. I leave on Thursday. A cross report comes in late on a Thursday. I don't see it until the following Tuesday, and by that time, you know, your worst case is, and it's a non. And I'm sorry, I got to go back just a little. When the cross reports come in, if it's not family related, DHS doesn't respond to them because it's not a family issue. So, for my example, was that. If a teen comes to school, confides in somebody, I've been abused by my neighbor for all this time, this wouldn't be a family thing, so DHS wouldn't necessarily respond to it, so we would get a cross report. So this sits for 4 or 5 days, nobody sees it, nobody gets a chance to look at it, falls by the wayside, and the kid harms themselves. That was my biggest fear of what would happen. So we set up a system in ours where the cross reports no longer came directly to us, but they went to our dispatch center. Each one was made into a call, and then the calls were dispatched directly to an officer, and each officer has to respond to every single cross report. Doesn't matter what the topic is. Then we have basically 5 layers of what the officer is able to do with it. The first one is a no action. They're called red letters. Basically, a drug-affected mother has been found to be pregnant again, and this is just sort of a informational. We don't expect the officers to actually do anything with that because there's nothing we can do about them. The second one is that an officer will go to the house, and let's say it's a dirty house because this is my favorite. It's the dirty house. They go to the dirty house, and this is a disgruntled. Somebody has called this in, and it's just completely unfounded. They'll write a small note on the cross report. I then get it, and by the way, I'm the backstop for all this. So they'll write a small note on the top, says, "Hey, I went there. It's just completely unfounded. House cleaner than mine," and they're done with it. Second is they'll go to the house, and let's say the house is dirty, but it doesn't rise to a criminal level. They have an option of either writing a note on the cross report, or they have an option of making a report. And we've really emphasized to our officers that, hey, if this is a repeat problem, if these are people that have had previous contacts, then you should do a report. Let's get it documented. Because what I'm I guess what I'm going to talk to about at the end is how does each agency find out about this, because these people are sort of transient. So the third thing would be is they go to a house, whatever the problem is actually criminal. They take a criminal investigation and they finish it off themselves. But the last thing is if they go and it's a criminal investigation and it turns out it's really bad, I get the bad cases, the serious abuse cases, the sexual abuses, they'll take an initial case report and then they'll forward it to me. So as I said, I'm sort of the backstop for all these. So all these ones that come through that there's really no action, I will read each one. I get about 400 a year for just our small town of Newport. And I'll look at each one of these and go, yeah, what the officer did looks to be appropriate compared to his notes. And then if there are cases, I'll do the same thing. I'll look and I'll make sure that there's no follow-up needed for the cases. So we're talking about cross-reporting. So the problem here is that the cross-reports are only good as people, as the people who are talking about them. So we have our MDTs, and thanks to the Carley's Law, we're required to get together and we're required to, share all these cases and review them. But the problem is if I miss a car or if I miss an MDT and one of my previous cases comes up for like Lincoln City and they talk about it, I'm not there to share. So that person doesn't know that, this person maybe had a previous contact with law enforcement and has a previous case because we're not on the same computer system. And there's the idea that I brought to Chair Gelsler, that we need a systematic sort of statewide system where all of our cases are input. Not where everything is input, all the data, but at least a place where we can have a resource where an officer can look and see all the people that are involved. Because the fact is, these people are transient. That, my client today has enough heat on them that they then move over to Sweet Home. And then they get enough there and they move over to Bend. And then they move over to Malheur County. And I don't, because we talk within our counties that are MDTs, we don't have the opportunity to know these things throughout the county or the state. So I have talked to Senator about a proposal of having a system where just minimal amount of information is input. People, the child, the parents, and other people that were involved, and the case numbers, where we could go and actually look and then contact the appropriate agency.
Great. Thank you very much. And this is a question for Lois too, but if someone calls your dispatch with a child abuse report, you always send that to DHS right away?
Yes.
As part of the cross-reporting. And if somebody reports it to DHS, they always send it to you right away as part of the cross-reporting.
That's true. I guess, but the problem here is the failing is between the cross-reporting system through the hotline is good. So I know everything that they get, even if they don't, everything that DHS got, regardless if they've responded to it or not, if it's an outside the family or it's just something that they didn't rise to their level. The failing in, Lois is going to have to talk to why exactly it is, but when I complete a report and it has something to do with children, we automatically, on my report box, we mark DHS, and everything we have automatically goes to them, and they, I'm guessing, give it to the particular case person or caseworker. It doesn't go the other way. Is that most of the time, if we have a case and we know that DHS is involved, we have to ask for stuff. And that we then get told, well, we have case notes, and if we ask for reports, then we can maybe get somebody to write us a report. But I have been told, and this is just anecdotal, and again, maybe Lois can speak to why, we've been told that they're not allowed to give us certain information. There's certain stuff that's privileged, and therefore it sort of hampers our ability to do our cases and what can be put or given to the DA's office. So in a particular case recently, we found out about 6 weeks after the fact, sitting in an MDT, we were talking about a particular case, and we found out that the caseworker that had gone and interviewed what was our suspect, the suspect had confessed to him, said, oh yeah, I did this to a minor child, and it had never been shared with us. And so this, we had no way of getting that into court. And it just so happens that in this particular case, that that person is also a minor. Try not to be too specific. That person's also a minor, and that person's parent has said, no, you're not interviewing them. But they've already, that information has already come to DHS. And if it wasn't for, sitting around at the MDT and that person saying, oh, by the way, this happened, we wouldn't have had any knowledge of that. So we don't automatically get the stuff as we would send it out, but we don't automatically get it back.
Thank you very much. So, childcare, how do you get information when there are investigations about the people that you are licensing?
Madam Chair, Committee, for the record, I'm David Mandel, Director of Policy and Research in the Early Learning Division, which also houses the Office of Child Care. And I have with me my colleague, Kathleen Hines, who is the Director of Legal and Compliance in the Office of Child Care. And I'll just give you sort of a broad overview and then turn it over to Kathleen, who can provide more detail. Just as a small background, I also want to make sure that there's no confusion between child caring programs under the jurisdiction of DHS and child care programs under the jurisdiction of Office of Child Care. It sounds very similar, but actually a completely different set of programs. And then also, this will be also become, I think, important as Kathleen talks a little bit more about the details. There's really three categories of child care programs that this may touch on. Licensed child care programs, which we have fundamental responsibility for licensing. There's also a large class of license-exempt providers, and then there's a sort of intermediary class of license-exempt providers who happen to be receiving employment-related daycare through DHS, and there's a little bit of a different route for all three of those. So my apologies for that complication, but it becomes important part of the story. Mm-hmm. And I'll hand it over to Kathleen to talk a little bit about the process that happens when a report comes into DHS. But it is also worth knowing that all licensed child care providers are mandatory reporters and are required to have received mandatory reporting training.
So very similar to law enforcement when a call.
Can you grab the microphone and start with your name, yes. Even though David so nicely introduced you.
That. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Hines, and I'm the Director of Legal and Compliance in the Office of Child Care within the Early Learning Division, Department of Education. And our overall responsibility is to enforce basic health and safety regulations for licensed child care facilities. When a report of child abuse comes into the hotline and it involves a child care setting, whether it be within a child care home, a licensed child care home where there's also family members, or whether it involves a child care facility, a center, Office of the Child Welfare Screening Hotline will treat that as a regular report of abuse, and they will cross-report it to us. That is in statute, that is in rules, and they cross-report it to us as well as law enforcement. We get that by telephone, we get it by fax, we get it by different kinds of information. We in the Office of Child Care will then follow up with the screening person, or with the child welfare worker that is assigned to investigate that case. We will track it with them. If appropriate, we will contact law enforcement and have interaction with them as well, and we will track that. If appropriate, we'll take action on the license. We do coordinate that action with DHS Child Welfare and law enforcement so that our actions will not interfere with any investigation that they're doing at that time. If our licensing specialists or a complainant see something that they think may rise to the level of child abuse or in any possible way, our training to our staff is that they report that, and that is within the expertise of DHS Child Welfare and the screeners to determine whether or not child abuse has occurred. And then we also, of course, will pursue our regulatory issues at the same time, whether or not there's been a violation of our regulations. We often will work in concert with the screener at DHS Child Welfare. We will provide them additional information that might be helpful in their determination of whether or not this is a situation, perhaps some history that we have with this child care facility that may help them in making their determination whether this is a case that they're going to go out and investigate. And then depending on the outcome of the child welfare investigation, we will take appropriate action on the license of the child care facility.
What happens if you have a provider? Will DHS notify you if they have, like, unrelated to the child caring itself, the person is a parent and they have been substantiated for physical abuse or sexual abuse of a child in their custody or care. Are you informed of that? And if so, is that reason to take action on their license?
Yes. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, yes, we are informed of that. We whether it's an allegation between the parent, who also happens to be a licensed child care provider, and their own child, or involves the child care children, we will be informed of that, and we'll take appropriate action.
And how does that become known? Is that just part of an investigation? That might be a question for Lois. Like, what's your job? Who do you work for? To notify you.
They have all of our contact information, and we get that. We'll get a fax, we'll get an email, we'll get a phone call, and we will act on that immediately.
Right, but how do they know, oh, we need to contact child care division because we've just taken a child protective action and this person is a child care provider? Like, how do they know that to contact you?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, it's in their administrative rules for DHS and in their procedures. And so if we also sometimes learn collaterally, because we're all a big system, and sometimes there can be a little gap if we hear from law enforcement or something, or collateral contact an involved parent, then we'll immediately contact DHS Child Welfare. I will also say we in the Office of Child Care in the Early Learning Division have access to the DHS database or our kids. And so once we know that there is a case involving an individual, we can access that information.
Okay.
Chair Gelser, committee members, just as a piece of background, I think it's helpful context here. All individuals who might possibly have unsupervised contact with children in a child care setting, whether they're working there, volunteering, or just happen to be a resident, particularly if need to be in our registry. So basically what the registry says is that if you're in the registry, what it means is that we have no prior evidence either from criminal background or child welfare that there's no prior knowledge of any reason why there shouldn't be unsupervised contact between that adult and the child.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And could we, so I see that Vicki Chamberlain is here from TSPC as well. Can you just come up for a second? Just, it's a similar question. Sorry. So Vicki, is there a similar process in place for you if you have a teacher that you've licensed and there's a protective action regarding their child, they've been substantiated for abuse? Are you contacted by DHS when that occurs, and does that impact the license of that teacher?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Yes, we regularly get cross reports from DHS, and they're assigned investigators immediately to determine whether there's a connection between the conduct once the report's finished and their license. I can't even tell you how many we receive a day, but we get them regularly.
Okay. Have you ever revoked a license on the basis of a substantiated allegation of abuse in the private life of a teacher?
Yes.
Or administrator?
Yes. Madam Chair, we have.
Great. The questions for this panel before we bring up DHS folks who are going to talk about internal, external? No? All right. Thank you very much. There's room for everybody at the actual table.
There is.
And to the power of telepathy, Chris has told me that Lois is speaking to external cross-reporting and Don is speaking to internal cross-reporting.
So, okay, I'm sorry. I'm trying to get myself back in that place. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, since Don has his PowerPoint up,
Okay.
How about we let Don talk about our internal cross-reporting, which would be that informing other programs within the department of what's occurring in each of the other programs. Don, are you all right with that? And
thank
if
you
want me to push this, just
yes,
tell me.
You can go ahead to the next slide. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Don Erickson, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Developmental Disabilities, Aging and People with Disabilities, and Vocational Rehabilitation. This topic is timely for a variety of reasons. One is that I also chair a work group that has been over the last, let's say, 6 months, been looking at our background check process in general. To evaluate it for efficiency, you know, is it really covering everything that we need to be covering? And in the course of that, we've had two gaps that I'll briefly report on here. One of them is, and this was a gap. The first one was a gap that both Lily and I came across, in part because of our backgrounds. We probably made an assumption that. All of our home care workers and personal support providers had child welfare background checks. Where we both came from, that would just normally be the case. And we discovered that, in fact, that's not the case, that the majority of our what we call PSWs, personal support workers, and our home care workers are not the CPS background check is not part of the standard check. And that's thousands and thousands of providers. And so we have created a solution for that. The solution is relatively easy, with the exception that it requires increased staffing for Frank Miles background check unit. We've been able to actually calculate exactly how many minutes per applicant it's going to take, and the number of people that are going to be required to be able to help us do that. And so we're trying to get that resource allocated, and so that we can initiate that process as soon as possible. That was a disconcerting insight for us some time ago. The other area that actually was brought to our attention, and more to the point of this discussion, that was brought to our attention recently, was that, again, if we look at our primary in-home providers, PSWs and home care workers, is that if a PSW who works predominantly for developmental disabilities clients, if they are found, if we have a substantiated claim of abuse or fraud, and that individual that's identified, and that individual loses their credentials to provide services for developmental disabilities programs, they can, or they've been able to simply sort of go across the street and become certified to provide in-home services for aging and people with disabilities, without any knowledge that they had been disqualified as a PSW. And obviously a huge and important gap. And again, if we look at the next, I think the next slide talks about the next one. That's this issue. And if you go to the last slide, the solution, again, is in this case is relatively easy. We're going to begin creating collaborative protocols between all of the relevant parties who should be privy to this information, and create the infrastructure to have that done routinely whenever a substantiated case of abuse or fraud is comes our way. Initially, that's going to be done manually. That'll be people sharing that information, making sure that happens. And what we'll look forward to in the future is having that automated.
Thank you. That's fantastic.
Great.
I don't know how to get this back, so if you know how to...
I do. Hit escape, and then your presentation will be...
Play with it.
I will play with it.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, as Senator Gelser noted before, we also have external cross-reporting requirements, and the detective spoke to that earlier, that there's a mandatory cross-report.
Senator Olson just pointed out that you have to introduce yourself again.
Thank you.
Sorry. It's like Groundhog Day, isn't it?
For the record, my name's Lois Day, and I'm the Child Welfare Director of the Department of Human Services. As was pointed out, we do have mandatory cross-reporting. It is covered in statute 419B017 between, child welfare and law enforcement. And we have notifications that occur during both our screening process and our investigation process for a number of other state and county service providers. The question came up earlier, how do we know someone's a child care provider when we go out to investigate? And there's a variety of ways. One is generally the reporting party tells us this person's providing child care. So it could be part of the screening process that we learn that. In our investigation with a family, there's a series of questions we would go through to ascertain first what occurred to the child in question and then what are the circumstances around them. It's not an incident-based investigation. It's called a comprehensive a comprehensive assessment. In the course of that, it may come out as well that they are providing child care. And I think it's similar with people who are teachers. It should be a part of the process of completing that comprehensive assessment that we get that information. Another issue that was raised with the prior participants was sharing information. I believe this is what the detective was speaking to, sharing information about our ongoing interaction with families after the assessment period is done and when there's potential for a criminal investigation continuing. I believe what would be, and I'll say this may be a gap, I'll start out by that because I was thinking about it when I was listening to the detective speak. I believe our best practice and what would be the common practice would be when we have a case open and we know that law enforcement is investigating the case, that there would be sharing back and forth of information. And we can share, I'll have Stacy speak to what we can and can't share, but we can share fairly freely with law enforcement because it's really in the best interest of the safety of children when their children involved with an investigation. It shouldn't be simply at MDT that information is shared if there's an ongoing investigation. So my hope would be that would be occurring with caseworkers even after the assessment is done. Frequently, we have cases in permanency, and there'll be a criminal investigation going on related to something that occurred to the child. There should be free conversation happening between the investigating agency and the department.
And is that something you can follow up with Detective France about after the hearing, just to maybe figure out what the missing loop is there?
Chair Gelser, I'm happy to follow up with him. Yes, I would. And I won't be able to speak with great conviction about this, but there is, and I say great conviction just because I don't want to get it wrong, but when there are two children in the custody of the department, which I don't think was what he was speaking of, and one potentially commits a crime against the other child, but they're both committed to the department has an obligation to protect the best interests of both those children, which may be, at times may appear in conflict with one another. And for us, it's important that we have a system in Oregon where every child committed to the department gets a court-appointed attorney, because they help us in those settings where we need to ensure that the victim gets that the crime, if it is a crime, is investigated and dealt with appropriately. And we also need to ensure that the rights of the offender child are protected as well. So.
Do you routinely, if in the course of an investigation, a child welfare investigation, encounter a crime that is being occurring in the house towards a child, towards someone else, are your workers obligated to always report that to law enforcement?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that does occur. I think frequently that occurs in cases where, not frequently, but it occurs in cases where there's domestic violence. I can imagine that's a scenario where we encounter that. I don't know specifically of a statute that requires us to cross-report any and all crimes. In child welfare, we are, of course, required to cross-report any crime or any abuse of a child, and then we allow law enforcement to determine if it rises to the level of a crime. That said, I think in our conversations, a scenario I could imagine would be where there was also perhaps an adult in the home, an elderly adult who was not being treated appropriately. That condition, if we discovered that while we were investigating child abuse or doing our comprehensive assessment, should be included in our narrative, which would then be cross-reported. Thank you. I don't know if you all have any other questions. I think that's...
Cross-reporting. Great. So I have made an error in that I thought that we had the committee until noon, but apparently we have the committee until 11. And I'm noticing my members sending me notes saying that they have to leave. And I have promised you, so I am happy to stay so that we can get it on the record. Or we can put it first up in the next one. But I am at your disposal to... I want to make sure that you have the opportunity to say the things you want to say today.
You.
And we can keep the room. Yes, and I know you guys can go.
But this is really important. I mean, is it possible that we could have some of this next?
Yes, absolutely. We will continue this next time. I just don't want to leave it open and not give Lois a chance to say some of the things she wanted today on this record in this hearing, but we can bring it back again as well.
Senator or Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I really appreciate that offer, and we are more than happy to return so that we can give a full picture, and hopefully, you know, I have a staff person who's been writing down your questions, and we can bring some clarification for the things that were raised today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. So you're okay waiting?
We are okay waiting.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. And I know that this hearing has put an enormous workload on the department, and I know all of you have worked very hard to prepare for the hearing, and I know there are a lot of people back at the office that we never, ever meet that have put an enormous amount of work into this. So I hope that you'll convey our thanks to them for all the work that goes into legislative days in general and this hearing in particular. I know has been pretty work intensive, so thank you very much.
Yeah, Chair Gelser will do that, and I just want to thank the committee and thank you for the opportunity to have some in-depth conversations about these issues. We don't frequently get this kind of committee time and aren't able to delve in at this level, so we really appreciate the opportunity.
So we will start off at the next committee days. We'll pull up the topics that we didn't get to, which are the cert reviews and the child welfare screenings, which really fits in with the QA overview, and because that's really what that's intended to be about.
Thank you.
And anything else that you forward to us that you think we should add. Great. All right. Thank you all very much for your attention and sticking with it today. And with that, we are adjourned until next time. Oh, it's okay.